It's time for Mac Break Weekly. Andy's here. Alex is here. Jason Snell's actually literally here sitting next to me. We're going to talk about that emergency rapid security response release from Apple. What's it all about? It's the first time they've done it. Did it work for you? We'll also talk about AI and why Apple's strategy is struggling. And the original Apple Store moving to a new home. Can you tell us where the original Apple Store was? Do you know? Stay tuned to find out. Mac Break Weekly is next.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 868, recorded Tuesday, May 2nd, 2023. Burglar Fantasy Camp. Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by Delete Me. Reclaim your privacy by removing personal data from online sources. Protect yourself and reduce the risk of fraud, spam, cybersecurity threats, and more by going to joindeleteme.com/twit and using the code TWIT for 20% off. And by ACI Learning. ACI Learning amplifies expertise across industries that command higher pay. ACI Learning, transforming how companies train and technology professionals learn to fuel the modern workforce. For premium training in audit, IT, and cybersecurity readiness, visit go.acilearning.com/twit. It's time for Mac Break Weekly, the show where we cover the latest Apple news. And we're going to find some Apple news, because you know why? Jason Snell braved the elements. It was pouring rain this morning.
I had no trouble getting here. There was no rain when I parted the skies.
Oh, nice.
And the sun led me here.
He parted. He came up.
Yep.
And like the Red Sea, it did. Got out of the way on 101.
Yep. Sonoma County said, welcome.
The cows moved over.
It's
nice to see you in studio.
It's good to be here. Wonderful. I thought I'd pop in.
Sixcolors.com. He's getting ready because Thursday you're going to be doing that.
I'm going to be making charts. I'm into the chart mines. Leo, after this, I go straight to the chart mines.
The chart mines.
I got to mine the colors.
We need colors.
I got to get the bars.
Need some indigo.
I got to get some pie. I got to make some pie.
Ochre for the red.
Yep.
Sixcolors.com. He's got all six of them. He's also, of course, a man of many podcasts. So we're always thrilled to have you.
More podcasts here than man now.
Yes. He's practically all podcasts. Mm. thanks for coming in. It's great to see you. Andy Yannacco can't because he's far, far away on the East Coast where the weather is crazy. Hi, Andy.
Yeah, we had a good 84, 85 degrees a couple weeks ago.
Jeez.
And once again, see what people who've never lived in New England like need to understand is that there are two specific phases of New Englanders being jerks and being stubborn. One comes in like October, November, where like, no, this isn't cold. I'm not turning on the heat. Like December. No, this isn't really cold. I'm not turning on the heat until you finally turn on the heat. And then comes a time in the spring where you turn the heat off again. And then even though like you get another like 8 weeks of like 43 degree weather.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm not turning the, oh, this isn't, oh, nope. Look, it's spring. They're buds.
Yep.
They're birds on the bough. They're buds on the bough. Like, ugh.
We had the weed whackers out to cut down the weeds that grew all because it was such a rainy winter all winter, and then it rained immediately after. So I thought, well, there you go. Also, from joining us from Hollywood, it's Mr. Alex Lindsay of Office
Hello,
Hours.
Hello.
Do you do office hours on the road?
I usually do, but the stuff that I'm doing right now overlaps office hours.
Oh, okay.
So it's an early morning activation. So I'm not on office hours for a couple days.
Okay. But still goes on. That's the beauty of office hours.
It does. It's a big, big web. So office. We had, I think today we had Nick Justician from Drexel University talking about Unreal Engine. And so didn't skip a beat.
Are you doing a lot of AI stuff on office hours now?
Oh, yeah.
I'm really trying to decide. I can't decide. We talked a little bit about doing This Week in AI, which has a terrible acronym, TWAY. I've got to do that.
It's all about me, Andy Yannacco.
That's kind of how we feel about
it. Yes. Wait a minute. That's your initials, Andy.
What did Andy Yannacco have to eat this morning?
I didn't think about that.
How did Andy Yannacco feel about the writer's strike?
I didn't even think about that.
We're looking for AGI coming up next, but
they don't realize that really AI is just Andy sitting there typing really fast. It's kind of like that shot from, you know, where he's just...
Actually, Andy could do that, I think.
He's supervising a large... room full of monkeys do the work for him, but he provides them guidance.
Nice.
It's actually improved the smell in the office. We're very, very happy with what you're doing.
So Apple pulled the emergency alarm. They pulled the thing, the rapid security response for the first time. Was it yesterday? For yeah. Mac OS and iOS and iPad OS. This was something
Subscript A. Yeah.
They had mentioned. Yeah, Subscript A is weird, isn't it? They had mentioned this last year at WWDC that they had this capability, but they'd never done it except for betas. I guess you'd experienced
they it. Betas, and it seems like they were just testing the facility of right. of doing this, which is, can we push out a security update that isn't wrapped in a full, you know, 13.3.2 update?
And people who, you know, see these updates, I know I do. I go, oh God. I'm not going to be able to use my phone for an hour, or I'm not going to use my Mac for an hour. This was very quick.
It's very fast. Yeah, they actually had to do some work to break the system up into little pieces so that they could, because the whole, you know, it's a whole locked system volume, right? So they've done the work of breaking it up into smaller pieces so that they can update a targeted portion of the system volume that's cryptographically signed and locked and all of that, and they can open that up, replace it, and that should theoretically mean that the updates are faster and smaller.
Let's see. Have they said anything about A1641A? No. Mm-mm. So we don't know what was in that.
Something important enough to do it, but that's all we know.
Is that really the case? So it's an emergency.
That's how it's supposed to be used. Yeah. Is otherwise they would roll it into 13.3.2 and 16.4.2, and instead it's 13.3.1A, which lets them just get that out faster without. I'd imagine also it's not disrupting their development, you know, whatever bug fixes or improvements or whatever they're working on in 13.3.2 doesn't get necessarily derailed by this because they can push this out faster.
Last week on Security Now, Steve Gibson talked about some 0 days that Pegasus was taking advantage of on iOS, and I, you know, Pegasus style zero click exploits. It was my understanding that they'd been patched already. But maybe not. Maybe not. Maybe maybe there was something left with these zero. And a 0 day is the kind of thing you'd pull the trigger for.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was reading that there was something. I didn't bookmark it for the notes, but there was some sort of news item about how there was a new Mac malware as a service that had sprung up.
Yeah.
And don't know if that's to address this thing, but who knows?
Well, some of the Apple's got a bunch of different facilities now to fight bad software, right? Because they've actually got their own anti-malware software that runs on your Mac and checks back home with Apple, and they update the definitions, and they can kill apps immediately. Basically, they can kill apps very, very quickly. That's not this, though. So this is obviously something that required a change to something that's in one of their sealed system volumes somewhere. The actual have to make changes to the OS in order to address it.
So Andrew Cunningham said it's often WebKit related. Of course, that's WebKit is kind of your interface to the outside world. So naturally, messages in WebKit are where a lot of these exploits happen. I should point out that there was a NSO zero click 2 weeks ago that used HomeKit, and lockdown mode succeeded in preventing it. Of course, most of us do not run lockdown mode because it is so draconian. But the people who are presumably the target of these kinds of NSO group attacks presumably would be. I don't know. It's just speculation.
According to Andrew Cunningham, who does great work on this subject at Ars Technica, in his Ventura review, he actually mentioned these things called cryptexes, which are the idea that they're not just having a single volume with all your system files in it. They've got the smaller little micro system volumes that you can update without having to deal with the whole system.
So instead of gigabytes, it's megabytes.
Yeah, it's much smaller and much faster. Could theoretically not require a reboot, although this one does. But he said in his Ventura review last summer that specifically Safari stuff and WebKit stuff was going to be in those cryptexes because obviously they identified where would we most likely need an emergency security update. Right.
And the NSO group always targeted messages as well. So I'm guessing that messages was, you know, Google did something similar with Android a few years ago where they moved a lot of stuff into the store. So they wouldn't even have to do this kind of update. They would just push it down through the Google Play store. It's kind of similar. The idea is let's break this up into small pieces where we just update this little function here.
Right, because 0 days aren't going to wait for you to release a software update in 2 weeks, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And also to make sure that they could push out that update as quickly as possible without having to wait for like Samsung or OnePlus or AT&T or Verizon to build that into whatever release they're going to be pushing out to their own phones, yeah.
And don't freak out if you haven't got it yet, because it is a rolling release. This, according to Aaron P613 on the Twitter, we know he's a reliable source. I don't know. This is the code, I guess. And so I don't know what that means. But somehow by looking at that code, you can see the granular ramping logic. And so it's going to roll out over 48 hours.
Well, as logical as it is to have this system for rapid response, you also don't want to release something that borks everybody's systems without having it.
Bork them a little at a time, I find.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, that's how you do it, right? Right. And then if everybody's borked, then you stop the rollout for a while.
Right.
And if not, then you keep it going. It's going to still be more rapid than if we had to wait for 13.3.2 to be released in 2 weeks.
So I guess the advice is, Lisa asked me yesterday, she said, have you heard about this? I said, no, what? She said, oh, I got to tell you something. And after gloating for a little bit, she then said, but I have seen on Twitter some people saying it's problematic, but I think the advice would be, even if you're not a Hollywood celebrity living in the hills with your own private screening room, you probably should update your
See, being in the studio means I got to see Alex give you side eye. That was really special.
Never mind. I said nothing.
Everybody should update. I mean, we always say that anyway, right? That the security issues are real and everybody should update. And you know, you might think I'm not a target, but like a zero click, Or even some of the stuff that's click-based, like people send junk texts to just random people all the time. And if they have an exploit,
it's not sending them to you. It's sending them out to 60,000, 600,000 or 6 million. There's, you know, when you, no one, you know, a lot of these are just, we're just going to, you know, shotgun across every person we have a contact for and just see who shows up.
Yeah.
That's not the
case.
It
only has to be a tiny percentage.
Generally, though, with NSO group style, zero clicks, because those are
so valuable,
worth so much money that you're not going to use that, because the minute you do a 60,000 person attack, everybody
knows. No. You're definitely not doing that for that. Yeah, those are more.
It's true, but there's a whole gradient, right? And the idea is that, really, unless you've got a very good reason not to update your software, you should update your software. You've got, and it's not some sort of silly reason of like, oh, well, I'd just like to be up to date. You've got a good reason, which is there are security flaws. When they're fixing them, that means somebody knows about them and they could affect you when you're browsing the web, when you're getting a message. Yes, it's not the stuff that's been weaponized by groups like the NSO group, but it's still, I mean, you should do it.
You always have to tell people, it depends on your threat model. But in this case, if Apple's putting it out to everybody, there's a good reason.
And they're not adding features. They're not changing
stuff. It's an easy thing to do.
Security fix. This is what this is.
In fact, it's been a long time since anything Apple's pushed out has caused problems. I remember there was one 5 or 6 years ago that bricked your phone. But that hasn't happened recently.
Yeah.
And I think maybe that's the point of these rapid security response updates, is that they're so piecemeal that they're not risky.
I don't know what you all think, but I sometimes think that iOS 7 and the release of iOS 7 was such a big mistake on Apple's part, not because of anything in the content, because I would actually argue that skeuomorphism is more bad than good, and I think iOS 7 actually took the iPhone in a new direction. We can argue about that later. But here's my point. I can't tell you how many regular iPhone users I've talked to who have stopped updating their devices in general as a policy and have become super paranoid about it because of that one time that their iPhone updated and it completely changed the iPhone interface in an upsetting way without any warning. And like, that was a long time ago now, and yet the legacy of that, I still talk to people, friends and family, who used to be like, yeah, I'll update to the latest update. Yeah. They're now like, yeah, I don't really want to do that right now. And I'm like, you should do it. You know, I do that to my mom. I do that to friends in the community. And like, you should do it. But I get, like, everybody still feels burned by some software update that messed up their thing.
And we're not talking about necessarily jumping from system to system. We're talking about just running these incremental updates that you should do all the time. There's a lot of good reasons to not update system to system immediately. Oftentimes you want to, because it's not just Apple at that point. It's
All the third-party software.
All the third parties that haven't caught up. And there's and you want to look at them and look at their websites and say, are we're ready for this or we're not ready for this? And sometimes they're still not ready for it. So that is you might want to do slowly, but definitely these once you've committed to an operating system, these incremental
get the updates. Difference.
You want to know what it's like, just be a Windows user. That's always a lot of fun.
It's one of the big reasons that I just don't like... Like I don't like having a lot of Windows machines.
Yeah.
Is this like I had this thing with Oculus. I had the problem with Oculus was it was like Windows would update, Oculus would break. Then I'd have to update Oculus, then Windows would update and Oculus would break. And it was like every 2 weeks I had to figure out why Oculus wasn't working. And then finally I just was like, okay, I'm just gonna wait for Quest.
All right. So do it and don't worry about it. It seems to be harmless. It's an important thing. For iOS, iPadOS, and macOS. Apparently not watch or a TV. I don't know. I didn't see any updates.
That would be interesting because those are two apps without web browsers.
Andrew, you have maybe hit upon it. Maybe it was WebKit. Apple has dropped the lawsuit against the executive, Gerard Williams III. Who was a lead chip architect at Apple and left and founded Nuvia, which was then bought by, was it ARM that Qualcomm bought Nuvia? Qualcomm. And Apple sued saying you brought poached employees for Nuvia, your startup. Williams counterfiled his own lawsuit because saying Apple tried to stop me from hiring people. And is recruiting from me. It's one of those back and forth. Go ahead.
It's hard to do poaching or claim poaching in California.
Yeah.
Not allowed to do that.
Right. Yeah. Apple has requested that the case be dismissed. Doesn't explain why. Williams had failed to persuade a judge to dismiss Apple's complaint. Maybe Apple and Gerard have come to an agreement. I don't know. Anyway, it's over. So you can holster your weapons, kids.
Yeah, you can always tell when there's no, it's not a Samsung sort of lawsuit where there's no hatred. There's no real, there's basically, what are we hoping to get out of this? And both sides kind of realize that, okay, we're kind of done here.
Knock it off. It was a
It was a weird lawsuit anyway. It was basically hackles raised out to each other to make sure that you're not going to destroy each other. And then at some point you just put it away.
By the way, Alex Reswitz in our Discord says, nice haircut. You and I were at the, you know, it's funny because you mentioned last week you were going to go get your haircut. We have the same hair cutter. And I had a haircut the day before. And I said, you know, Alex is coming tomorrow. She said, no, he's not. I said, well, you better check because I think he is.
And there's a complicated web thing to sign up. And
it's really complicated.
And I didn't get to the end of it. So I was really glad that you did that because then she texted me and I was like, yeah, I'm coming. And I was like, oh no, I'm not coming. I don't have the little reminder. And then we sorted it out.
Pet peeve of mine. Everybody now has to have a web presence and web booking and stuff. Yeah. And they use the worst tools that are just out of date and they don't work very well. And they spin and they spin and they spin. And it's so frustrating. And then I was in IoT hell over my weekend trying to set up, I won't name names, but set up devices that were supposed to pair and didn't pair. And
I'm still waiting.
I have
waiting for that to sell.
I'll name names. I have this thing called a garden with a Y. Do you know about this? Where you grow, it's a hydroponic thing for your home where you grow your own vegetables and fruits. It's an Instagram. I fell for Instagram again. And, it's so hydroponic and it's cool. It's got lights and we've been growing lettuce in the hall. But it has to pair to your Wi-Fi. Why? Because who knows? Because everything has to pair to your Wi-Fi, except it won't now, which means the lights aren't coming on. And I don't know, my vegetables are going to die. And that's just very frustrating. Anyway, so IoT hell. They use the worst, cheapest possible chips that just don't pair to anything is the problem. And then they blame me. They say, well, you should restart your router. I said, I have 180 devices on this router, all of which are working fine. I don't think it's the router.
You know, I did get a hydroponic. My mother-in-law got us one of those hydroponic things with the light that turns on and off.
Yeah.
I found that putting them in a pot by the window.
That's probably better. Like the sun is magic.
There was a little bit of back and forth, and then I was like, I'm going to try the window. And it got really big, really fast.
I might have to move mine to the window, come to think of it.
Yeah, we have an aero garden, which is a similar thing, but not smart in any way. And other than having it turn off its very bright light when we're like watching TV in the evening, I had a salad the other day with lettuce from the aero garden.
Yeah, but do you have a time lapse of your... of your lettuce growing?
I don't.
Do you have pictures, right? You know, real-time pictures? See my vegetables? Can you see my vegetables?
Wow. The kids move out. And
when we were gone for 3 weeks, our 20-year-old was monitoring the house. Mm. And Lisa says, you know, the app says we need water. So he put literally a cup of water in it. The thing takes 5 gallons. When we got back, it was dry as a bone.
Yeah.
There was a little bit of yellowing. I think I like your idea, Alex. Maybe, I don't know, we could, I guess, plant it outside. And then the rain would water it sun would make it grow. Actually, one of my experiences with this stuff, and Lisa agrees, it doesn't have as much flavor as if it grew in dirt.
Yeah.
Is that the case?
I haven't experienced that. But.
Oh, okay. Maybe I need more flavorful vegetables.
Just pretend you're an astronaut.
You know,
going to Mars.
Eat potatoes.
There's a bunch of people listening to MacBreak going, what are they talking about?
Oh, never mind.
We don't know either.
Never mind. Apple.
Twig. Oh, we already have Twig. Oh, so This Week in Gardening, but it's already taken.
It's not taken. And you know what I do now with This Week in Google is I just stuff everything in there that has no other place. In fact, we're going to start doing an AI segment.
Just like Google. Perfect.
It's Google.
Yeah, exactly.
That's exactly it. Apple to upgrade its watch operating system with new focus on widgets. Wait a minute. This is from Mark Gurman. Haven't we been here before? This was the glances.
It's
thing.
A lot like the first. Yeah, but the glances, I mean, again, everything in that first generation of watch OS was
sort
of,
great.
Yeah.
Experimental.
Yeah. But this is the idea here is that widgets on iOS are actually already written using a system that could probably be just put on the watch. There's a lot of synergy between what's going on.
I like widgets on iOS.
Yeah. I do too. And the idea of getting more information on the watch screen that's not in an app, being able to sort of, they said, Mark Gurman's report suggests it's going to be a lot like the Siri watch face where you'll have some cards that are basically these widgets and you'll be able to scroll through them. And I think getting things to the watch face easily and not having to go and dig through and launch an app on your watch, which
absolutely
is a good direction. I mean, who knows about the implementation?
I miss
here,
that
but
Siri watch face.
Direction.
I kind of like that. I like
it's still there.
I want to get as much stuff on my watch as I can.
Yeah,
you know.
I have to say that that was one of the most useful parts of the first iteration of watchOS. I like the idea of you always have like the time in the corner of the screen, no matter what's happening. But sometimes all I want to see is here, please just, I just want a post-it note that just tells me, here is the names of the people that I'm meeting so I can keep glancing at it while I'm on the subway and remember how to greet the people. When I'm in a certain mode, I just want this watch to contain a certain piece of real-time information that doesn't, like as Jason says, doesn't require me to launch an app to get this going, doesn't require me to set up a complication for this one watch face for just this one 45-minute period. So I'm very excited to see how if this happens and they implement it really well, this could be a really, really great move forward. Also, I don't think I saw it in the show notes, but there was also a rumor that the next edition will also allow you to have Apple Health on iPads, on other devices, on devices other than the iPhone. If that's true, that might imply that you can actually support an Apple Watch without having necessarily owning an iPhone, which would be amazing for me. I've often complained that, gee, I have an Apple MacBook. I've got an Apple iPad. I've got two Apple iPads. I want to buy an Apple Watch, but because I don't have an iPhone, I don't get to play with the other kids. If I had the ability to use an actual Apple Watch, despite the fact that I've got an Android phone, I would be so into that ecosystem immediately.
There was also a rumor with watch. This is all Watch OS 10, the next Watch OS, which we'll find out about in about a month at WWDC. I think it's June 5th. The keynote. We'll be covering that live, of course. As will you, I'm sure, Jason.
Yeah, 6 weeks away. Hard to believe.
It's not even that, right? It's a little less now. We are May 2nd. So, yeah.
5 weeks away.
5 weeks.
Even harder to believe, really.
Yeah. Amazing. And Apple Watch may work with multiple iPhones and iPads, which is interesting. Yeah,
that's good.
I'm not sure. What is that? Why?
Well, what Andy said is one example is if you can set it up with an iPad, which is just literally just put the watch app on the iPad and let people do it because it's really integrated. The setup is really integrated with iOS and it does a lot of data goes back and forth. So it might be harder for them to do it with a Mac. They could, but it might be harder. But iPad OS is sitting right there. And if you're somebody like Andy who doesn't have an iPhone but does have an iPad, that's probably good enough to get by. And they just haven't done it. And I think their step one was letting you set up a kid's Apple Watch without
kids and seniors.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Where they don't have the iPhone there, somebody is setting it up for them. And the next phase, and you know, getting the App Store to be independent and all of those sort of things. But one of the things that's still sitting out there is the fact that, as Andy put it, it is essentially a mandatory iPhone accessory. That's what it is. You can't use it if you don't have an iPhone. And so this would be a nice step, I think. And some people, like, I don't use my iPhone nearly as much as I use my iPad. So, like, for me, I'm always frustrated when Apple does things that are only on the iPhone because, sometimes my iPhone isn't around. It's, in another room or I'm outside the house with just my cellular Apple Watch.
Good. Pay attention to the Apple Watch. It's a good thing, and we love it. And we'll call it the Get Andy on the Apple Watch ecosystem feature. We'll call that.
And it's, I think it's been around long enough now. It's coming up 9 years that it's time for a little bit of a rethink. I think they've learned a lot about how people use the watch now. And back 8 years ago, we might not have been like, what do you mean de-emphasizing apps? Apps are the lifeblood of all computing platforms. And now we're like, I use apps on my watch, but like, that's not where I live. I'm living at the top level and we've learned a lot and Apple's learned a lot. And so it's time to put some of that into practice.
Plus, listen, don't overlook the fact that there's just nothing quite like the Apple Watch on the Android platform. The closest that you come is the Samsung Gear watches, but you can't use them without signing up for like 100 different Samsung accounts, which is terrible. They're big and chunky. They're like diver style watches. They're not like elegant, nice fashion watches. We've seen how Apple is willing to sell a $30 AirTag or $100 AirPods if it means having more money, selling more things to more people. My goodness, the things that they would, the volume that they would sell to the Android market if Android users could actually use an Apple Watch. And like Jason said, not necessarily by creating a watch app for Android, but simply by acknowledging that, gee, this is already pretty much a standalone product as it is. I believe that we could sign it up onto the network, onto a Wi-Fi network just by itself, or worse comes to worse, the same way that you sign on to a service on Apple TV where it just simply says, go to this URL, go on any web browser, type in this code, and then it will communicate through the internet to this watch or over the Wi-Fi network and it will set it up for you.
Would you, let me think though, if you didn't have a phone setting up your watch, but an iPad setting up your watch, how would that work you're not going to take your iPad with you everywhere, are
well,
you?
I mean, first off, they have a cellular model that is theoretically working standalone. And if you're on Wi-Fi and on a Wi-Fi network, you could theoretically talk to a data store, whether it's iCloud or
through
even
the cellular network to the Wi-Fi.
Even back to your device. One of the, but I do that. I go outside all the time
without your phone,
without my phone, and it works fine.
You can receive calls. You can place calls.
There are certain apps that won't do it because they really want the iPhone to be there, but there are also lots where it works fine.
Well, and those apps would have to fix themselves.
They would, yes. They need to learn about what they've done and think about that.
Think about what you've done.
Sit in a corner.
Yeah. Yep. Speaking of AirTags, Apple and Google both have teamed up to work together to prevent lost item trackers from being used to track people without their permission. This is something that's been a little bit of an issue for Apple. It's been an issue for Tile. Google does not yet sell tags, right? But there's been a strong rumor for a long time. Andy, you cover Android and your material podcast, that they're going to do that. So maybe this is a sign that Google's going to announce something at Google I.O.
Yeah, and it's also it's just long overdue. This is a valuable market. This is a device that people want, but there's just no safe way to market this thing. I mean,
Apple makes an Android app that works like about half the time, and you have to know about it, and you have to have it installed. Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, this is both companies doing things, particularly Apple, doing something that's very, very responsible. What they're proposing is that they've already gotten together and proposed a specification that would be platform agnostic. It would just be a resource that anybody could put into anything. It's a proposed industry specification to help combat the misuse of Bluetooth location device for unmarked tracking. And it's basically, it basically means that no matter what your alert system is, it will work with any compatible device.
Samsung, Tile, or AirTags, or whatever Google might announce. And it's built into the OS, iPhone and Android. Right. And that's kind of what you want, so that if somebody's tracking you, just for people who haven't experienced this, I experience it all the time, it will pop a message saying there's an AirTag following you around and it's not yours. You should know about this. Have you guys seen this?
And, oh, yeah.
It would be interesting. Yeah. I read it. So simultaneous press releases on Google and Apple's news sites, and neither of them answer a certain question about whether or not this common specification on both platforms would also extend the Find My network, so that now every Android phone is also helping you locate the Find My devices, which would in itself be pretty darn interesting, because if I could also locate a lost phone or a lost Chromebook based on the fact that someone with an iPhone has recently passed by wherever I left it behind, that would be pretty slick too.
One of the things I'm kind of curious about, though, is that what happens if someone steals something of yours that has that AirTag? You don't necessarily want to turn that off. it's tracking them now because they stole your bag. Or what do airlines do when they just decide, you know, they're going to turn off people's AirTags if they're, you know, like I put all my cases all now have AirTags in them. And, you know, I'm not super excited about the ideas of the airline or baggage or whatever deciding to turn off my AirTags.
How would they turn it off? You mean find them take them out?
If it says that you're being tracked.
Oh, they would see it.
They would see it, and then they would...
Like the airplane, put a little iPhone in the airplane, and they could see all the air tags in the
AirTags are all sitting there. They're all sitting in the bay when they go through. And I just, you know, there's a... So, I definitely see why you don't want to track people, but I think that what will end up happening is it'll affect a lot more people.
We'll see.
Because I don't think that many people are tracking other people with AirTags. Yeah. So
there are better ways to do it, probably.
Edge case. There's a lot of better ways to do it.
Yeah.
And so I think it's an edge case, and I think when they solve that edge case, the less edge case is going to be valid reasons why there's a tracker that happens to be going along someone who took something from you or baggage claim or something else and it gets turned off.
Right.
You know, I think that that's going to be a more likely thing to occur than people actually tracking each other.
I'm actually surprised that airlines don't have Faraday cages in their luggage compartments, right? So, I mean, you don't want anything transmitting out of the luggage compartment.
I don't think you see it. Once it takes off, you don't really know. So far, my experience has been once it takes off, it doesn't, you know, your phones aren't really getting anywhere.
Right.
They're just burning up battery trying to find something. Right. And so every once in a while, you'll see it appear. But overall, I think that, you know, when we're doing
when your bags are on the ground that they might want you to know we've sent them on to Philadelphia.
Well, like a good example is we gave it to a shipper who's a really good shipper. I'm not going to name them because we like using them. But, you know, we have an expectation that, you know, I gave them 10 bags that had, you know, $250,000 of hardware in them. And I expect that to go to a warehouse. And when I looked at the trackers, I saw this little cloud that was at somebody's house.
Oh, that's like, not what you want.
You know, and then it went down and it drops off and then that was fine. And then then when they picked it up, they went to somebody's house again and then they went off, you know, but they obviously had spent the night at a house. Now maybe they put it in a garage, I have to admit the shininess of that company. Yeah. Little worn off, you know, because I was expecting to go to some kind of secure facility.
No, all the companies now do weird stuff like that. In fact, I saw a UPS van out in the lot, pulled up next to a sedan, and the guy was taking packages off the UPS truck and stuffing them into the sedan, like filling up the back seat. And I thought, should I call the cops on this? And then it turns out that what they do is they hire these freelance ununiformed people to do deliveries. And that's what's going on. They're taking some, offloading them. And maybe that guy decides to park his Buick in his garage overnight.
Well, it was less expensive than to send it by air. So I'm sure that they have a different way of doing it. But it was a guy, you know, the guy with his van.
Yeah.
And it's a nice van when it showed up. We filled it up with.
Yeah. See, there you go. But it was just some freelancer. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Apple and Google said the features will be completed by the end of the year and implemented in future versions of iOS and Android. But this is the right direction anyway. It's kind of nice to see Apple and Google doing something together, hand in hand, arm in arm.
This is the last time we saw that Apple Google logo was, of course, when they did COVID
thing. Yeah.
Yep.
And Matter, right? Matter, the Matter standard, aren't Apple and Google both in the Matter?
Yeah, I don't think they did the joint press release for that.
Oh,
right. They're both on board. They didn't develop it together. Right. I mean, I'm looking at the draft specification here, and it really does seem very thorough about the difference between making sure basically it controls like when the tracker should advertise its presence and when it should advertise its presence.
Oh, that's good.
So it basically goes from case to case to case to case between, like, if someone has activated it saying that, hey, this thing is lost, please broadcast your location, versus someone who is trying to track they know that I have an AirTag inside my bag and so they can track me by tracking my location via that air tracker, or having an AirTag that doesn't belong to me that's been slipped into my luggage or slipped into my car. It does seem to be very, very thorough, and there's a lot of, as you'd expect, a lot of language about basically making sure that this doesn't screw up people's lives when they don't want to be, when they don't want to be bothered by it doesn't protect it. Sorry about that. It doesn't prevent the feature from working as it's supposed to work. Also doesn't cause problems for people who want this thing to remain silent.
I mean, I definitely think that it'll be interesting to see how things like airlines use it, because not only I, but other people have been able to tell the airline more accurately than it knows where our bags are. We've gone, you know, like I FedEx couldn't find one of my bags, and I was like, it's in the LAX FedEx in the back corner.
That probably drives them crazy.
Like, here is, you know, it's in the last crazy little, like, I know exactly where
everybody
that bag
knows
is
now.
And I know there's at least one airline that sort of said, don't do it. And Lufthansa, it's like, okay.
Lufthansa briefly said that we were going to ban it.
Just
but
don't
then
do
they
it.
Realized.
It's like, well, what are you going to do? And the same is true with this, which is, what are you going to do? You're not going to, I mean.
Right.
Everybody, they're going to know that they're being tracked, and I think a delivery company is going to know that they're being tracked. I think that's okay. I would say though that the two things that are at cross purposes here do seem to be people who are trying to prevent thefts and people who are trying to prevent stalking, because those are similar profiles. So that's the tricky part. We just had it's even in our show list. The mayor of New York City stood up and said, we're going to put air tags in people's cars and use them to stop car theft.
It's what?
Like, okay.
Someone donated 500 air tags available for free to people to add to their cars. And the police are actually also recommending air tags.
It's a terrible idea.
This is why we talk about people who run the government oftentimes are digital children, and they don't understand there are so many better ways to do this.
This is as bad as Adams, you know, like Eric Adams saying, I'm going to take my salary in Bitcoin, which, by the way, he quickly changed his tune on that one.
A lot of people I know refer to him as Mayor That Guy now.
That guy.
Right? It's that guy. But this is such a weird thing. But I mean, again, I get the impulse. My son, when he, you know, started riding his bike to high school, I mounted an AirTag in a, you know, undisclosed location in case it got stolen. Like, I totally get it. Even though Apple says this is not for tracking stolen items, it's for tracking lost items, and I know they say that, but that is at cross purposes. If they make this really good so that you know immediately that you're being stalked, it also means that whoever stole your bike knows that they are being tracked,
right?
And they can look for the tracker,
look for the AirTag,
and remove it.
Yeah.
And that's just how it is. I mean, you just have to deal with those two things being at cross purposes. And I think in the end, trying to protect people will probably win. And I think that's the right call.
So the AirTags, there's 500 of them. How many people in the Bronx? More than a million. So 500 of you lucky people will get AirTags. NYPD, Eric Adams said, the mayor said, that guy, will not track the AirTags being given away. Instead, when owners realize their car is missing, they can notify police, who will track the stolen vehicle with the owner's permission. How are you going to do that? You're going to give you, I'll give you a login to my Apple account.
I'm so not.
And
I think that may just be don't take the law into your own hands. Call the police.
Well, see, that's the real thing. That's the real risk is, okay, now I'm going to add it to my Find My, and I'm going to go track that guy down. Yeah.
And that's dangerous.
You don't want that.
Yeah.
Okay.
AirTags is a technology that has turned out to not be as revolutionary as we maybe hope that it might be in a way that, you know, some technologies do change the world, but AirTags, I think, maybe not one of them.
Isn't there LoJack? There are ways to do this. That's what LoJack did.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are other tools for stalkers that are much more efficient than this.
Yeah, you can buy a GPS for less than an AirTag.
And for cars, yeah.
The 500 AirTags are being provided by the Association for a Better New York, or ABNY. A nonprofit dedicated to the continuous growth and renewal of New York City's peoples, communities, and businesses. The mayor urged all car owners to consider AirTags for their vehicles. Oh,
I mean,
Lord.
And the thing is that the things that have been more effective in cities that have decided to do this is to you take the cars that are most likely to be stolen. They know that statistically. You take it to the locations that are most likely to be stolen. They know what that statistically is. And you start baiting it. You know, you start dropping bait and you have GPS LoJacks, and then you don't do anything with it. You let it roam around. You let people steal it. You let them take them. You let them, you know, and what you do is you start building up a, you know, profile of the entire network, and then you take down the entire network.
Right.
That's
because it's not individuals stealing cars so much as chop shops.
No, it's a network. And so you see, you know, and if you, you know, depending on what, how much data you have, you can attach their phone position to the, to the tracker. Then you follow as soon as the phone is going the same direction as the car, as the tracker, after it's been stolen, every phone that drives along in that thing becomes part of that net, you know, that they pull in. And at that point, they're able to, you know, when you're wondering why they want all that metadata, like, it's because, you know, you start taking all that information, and that information is not the metadata that NSA gets. That's just antenna and metadata. And so once you have all of that information, you can build a very complex web. But they're choosing, you know, a lot of times they're choosing not to do that for a variety of reasons, but that is the, that's what can be done. And that's how there are certain cities that have gotten rid of a lot of theft by letting it just run for 6 months, figuring out who is who, and then just arresting
them. Yeah, that's the better way to do it. Yeah. I watch The Wire. I know. You got to roll up those networks. You got to roll them up. Apparently, this is in response to the TikTok trend of stealing Kia's Hyundais, because they're fairly easy to steal. And of course, Kia has responded by adding software updates and lockout features and things like that. So maybe it's an problem.
I use AirTags in my cars mostly to get back to why Apple.
I know why you do, because you lost your car.
Can't find my car. Like, I get back and I go, where? Because I haven't traveled enough. That little part of my brain isn't working anymore. I'm like, I don't remember whether I was on level 3 or level 4. And so I know why you do it.
Super useful. But actually,
I have no car that anyone would want to steal. Like, my car is like,
I'm thinking, don't like, I feel like Apple Maps and Google Maps put a pin in where you park.
Yeah, they do. When you disconnect, if you're on Bluetooth in a car and then you turn it off, it sees the Bluetooth disconnect and it drops essentially a special pin to say your parked car is here, although that doesn't necessarily help you on a multi-level parking garage.
That's the problem. The problem is that it shows me where it is, but it's in this garage.
You knew that.
Yeah, I did. I knew where it was, but I didn't know what, I couldn't remember what floor, so it was.
Okay, I've done the walk of shame where you go around with your clicker on every floor going, is it here?
Here is a pro tip for everybody. When you park in a big parking lot, take a picture of it with your cell phone so that you can come back later and you know where it is.
That's what I do.
Yep. Take a picture of the letter, like
of the pole that's got the letter on it. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Exactly.
Pro tip. Is that a pro tip?
Yeah. And if I thought it was a pro tip 15 years ago and we're still here. So I guess it's still a pro tip. It hasn't retired yet. And then the other thing is, if you've got a rental car, take a picture of the license plate so you can identify it, so you know which car is yours.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
We have phones in our pockets now. You should never get lost again.
I found that there are, for a while, GM only had 27 keys, and I actually did successfully walk up to the wrong car, put my key in, open it up.
And it worked.
And like, I opened it up, sat in the car, and said, I'm in the wrong car.
Oh my God.
I have no idea how I got here.
So, that's not good. No, holy cow. It is true that half of my pictures now are of receipts, of menus, of cars, license.
Nothing like iCloud shared photos to share your pictures of your license plate in that parking garage with your loved ones.
Google Photos has a nice feature where it looks for that stuff and then says, you want to move this into archive.
I used to have it on Photos. I used to just share my photos with my Apple TV, and then my wife and my kids could see what I was doing all over the world because I'm traveling, and I would take all these pictures. And my wife finally said, you got to stop doing it. I was like, do you don't like the photos? She's like, I'm just tired of looking at receipts. Yeah. Like, there's like receipts floating around on the
TV. Yeah, the last five pictures I've taken, one are of the menu, three are of computer screens, and four of my lettuce. So
my last one is just a picture of the Ethernet port, me trying to figure out where in the facility I can get Ethernet for the show.
I have a lot of pictures of the backs of TVs and of, you know, what model it is and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
But that's what, you know, thank goodness for the camera phone. And I have to say, I did not miss a nice camera on our trip. I was able to get everything I wanted with the iPhone. And it was convenient because the iPhone's doing GPS. So I know exactly where the picture was. Mm-hmm. I was able to add it to day one. We talked about this before, but it's just nice that it's one box.
Have you built up the habit that you always wipe the lens? I wipe everything I'm about to take a photo that I care about. You can always tell I'm about to because I wipe the lens. Yeah. I wipe the lens. Because otherwise, when someone sends me a misty photo, I'm always like,
The lens. It's greasy. I kind of think about, what's on there?
And it does that really fast. It's funny. It only takes a couple, like, put it in your pocket before you need the lens.
Samsung's will tell you to wipe your lens.
You need a microfiber lined pocket.
that's a good idea.
Same thing with Google's Pixel phones. That will tell you that it appears that your lens is blurred.
It's an Android feature then, maybe. Yeah, that's nice. You know, you got schmutz on the lens.
Apple will have a little wiper blade that extends out of the phone and then pulls back in, R2-D2 style. Yeah.
I just want to warn you ahead of time. I'm not going to go down the path of what the iPhone 15 is going to look like or be like, or buttons or no buttons or all that stuff.
Round.
Okay.
It's round.
Until we really run out of news. And then. Yeah, all bets are off.
iPhone 15, the disc.
We got to put some acorns away for the long, long winter.
Stir away from some nuts.
You were gone. We were desperate. Okay,
it's pretty bad. It gets bad.
I have no regrets.
No regrets. WWDC cannot come soon enough. Oh, then we will have much grist for the mill.
Indeed.
In fact, it might be worth $3,000 to buy that thing. So that we could just talk about it for the next 6 months.
Yeah, but you're not going to be able to buy it until probably the end of the year.
Fall, I think.
Let's take a break. Our show today brought to you by a new sponsor. We want to welcome them, and just in the nick of time, Delete Me. Delete Me. Have you, good Lord. What with data brokers scooping up every bit of information about you, have you, you know, ever searched for your name online and noticed all the, they call it PI, personal information that's available, including, you know, things like your home address, your phone number? Kind of creepy and scary. Since 2010, Delete Me has been on a mission to empower individuals and organizations, allowing them to reclaim their privacy and help them remove personal data from online sources. You know, you could do it one by one, but the problem is there's so many of them and you don't know about all of them. And so Delete Me is great. They have a whole team dedicated by and driven by a passion for privacy and commitment to make it easy for you. So you reduce the risk of identity theft, credit card fraud. It will reduce your spam, your robocalls, harassment. Generally, just all kinds of unwanted communications. Delete Me is the most trusted privacy solution available. Thousands of customers have used it to remove personal information online. The average person has more than 2,000 pieces of data about them online. Delete Me can find it and remove it. And as I said, you can do it yourself. But who has? No, ain't nobody got time for that. Delete Me has now up to date, removed more than 50 million pieces of data for their customers. One customer said, I signed up. They took it from there. Awesome service, already seeing results. So here's how it works. You're going to sign up. You're going to give them some basic personal information because they need to know what they're looking for. And they will then go out to, get this number, 580 different data brokers. Can you believe that? 580. And I bet you it's 581 by the time I say that sentence. They'll go out, they'll find it, they'll remove your personal information. Just go to joindeleteme.com/twit. Once the removal process starts, you're going to get a report within a week, 7 days, a detailed report of what they've done, so you know if you're, you know, it's working. But here's the key, because there's always new ones coming up. It's going to continue to scan and remove your personal information. Every 3 months, every quarter, they go out, psh, get rid of that stuff. It's automated removal. They also opt out monitoring. They'll ensure records don't get repopulated after being removed. The law requires a lot of these guys to say, you know, have a form, if you can find it on the webpage, where you say, I don't want you, you know, stop it. Delete Me will do that all for you. They know exactly where to go and how to do it. That's names. That's addresses. It's photos. It's emails. It's relatives' names. It's phone numbers, social media, your property value. PC Magazine gave them an excellent rating. This is the one that really works, as the data broker industry just takes over and changes and expands. They continue to add new sites and features because they want to make their service, Delete Me service, both simple to use and effective in removing personally identifiable information, PII. And since privacy exposures and incidents affect everybody differently, they've got privacy advisors who can help you. They can give you the support you need to know what's bad, what's good, what to worry about. I think it's a good service, and I think you want to check it out. Plus, we've got 20% off for you right now. Protect yourself. Reclaim your privacy. Go to joindeleteme.com/twit. The offer code TWIT. And you don't have to worry. They'll know it was on MacBreak Weekly. Joindeleteme.com/twit. Offer code TWIT. At checkout, you'll get 20% off. This is I tell you what, just go out and search for your name and you'll know why you need this. Delete Me. Joindeleteme.com/twit. Offer code TWIT. Please use that offer code too so they know you saw it on MacBreak Weekly. Let's see here. Apple's going to redo its first Apple store. Ironically, at the same time as their employees are about to unionize. Maybe, I don't know if there's something going on there. The very first Apple store was outside Washington, D.C., Tyson's Center.
Yeah, Tyson.
There's a Towson's, Maryland, but this is Tyson's, Virginia. It's actually technically McLean.
Right. Towson is where the...
That's where the union is?
Union is in Tyson's.
Oh, okay. So I'm sorry. I apologize. Tyson's Corner. Tyson's Center. We don't know if they're going to unionize or not. That's Towson. And that's my confusion. Not
Tyson
yours.
And Towson.
Thank you for
Towson
clearing that up. Apparently, both Apple opened two stores in May of 2001, 22 years ago.
Hard to believe.
Can you believe that? One was in Glendale, but because the Virginia site is on the East Coast, it counts as the first.
Yeah, this is a long debate, actually. All the people in Glendale are like, no, Glendale Galleria is number one. Absolutely.
No, and by
3 hours it wasn't. It was number two, and Apple, you know, admitted as much in saying, I don't know, they've probably done that before, been saying this is store number one, and it's going to be redone now.
It's going to be like Jobs and Woz. They're going to call it store zero.
I remember, I mean, we had a freelancer in Glendale covering the opening of the Apple store for Macworld, and I cannot believe that was
22 years ago. Here's what it looks like right now. They've got it all boarded up because it's in a mall, and they've got a little sign that says, hello, period, again, period. The first ever Apple store opened 22 years ago. At Tyson's Corner. Soon we look forward to welcoming you to this newly reimagined space.
Ooh.
Wow.
That's going to be interesting. I actually visited. I was in the area on business. And of course, of all the things to visit, like in Maryland and near DC, it's like, oh no, I want to see Apple store number one. And it's very, very nice, but it's not terrible. It wasn't terribly well lit. It was definitely like very old school. So I can imagine them putting like a lot more lighting in there, giving it the modern touch. I was trying to look at those pictures though. I was trying to figure out, I've never seen that version of the Apple logo with the six colors vertically striped in three as a 3D sweep before. Has anybody else seen one?
Huh.
Hmm.
Huh. Nope.
They've got the invite for the WWDC has a six color in a few different configurations, but I'm not sure in that one. Mm.
You can go to the departmentmap.store/time machine and download all of the historic pictures of the original Apple stores, May 19th, 2001, 22 years ago, that store opened. You know, before that, people probably forgot that you would go to a Best Buy and then be an Apple corner, a fly-specked and neglected Apple corner where some poor Apple employee had to stand and wait for people to come over. And Apple was quite wise. They said, if we're going to succeed in a Windows world, we're going to have our own stores where we can really position our products. And it worked.
They weren't competing on commission. So as a result, the people who worked at those stores weren't really incentivized to even keep, not only incentivized to sell Macs, but also just to keep the display models running. They would just simply be dead screens.
Yeah.
So yeah, this is, they did such an amazing job of turning each of these Apple stores into an embassy of, you know, of the Apple faithful, and basically giving, turning one of Apple's biggest problems, meaning where do you go to get these things serviced, where do you go to actually find one of these things for sale and working, to one of the biggest advantages that, well, if it breaks or if you have any problems with it or if you need instruction on how to use iMovie, you go to your mall.
Yeah.
Which is probably for most people in the country, in this country at least, about a 20-minute drive away.
It's been really powerful when you look at what Apple does with their stores, you know, whether it's the classes, you know, basic instruction, you know, tech support, as well as selling things. So there's a lot of flow. And I think a lot of other companies like Microsoft have had a hard time reproducing that, of having something there that, you know, they've tried, and they just, it's just very hard to get that magic just right. But you know, I often wander into Apple stores for no reason. I'm just going to wander in. I'm going to play with a couple things I don't own, and then I'm going to wander out again. But when you look at my kids go for the classes are unbelievable. Like, these aren't like little, like we made up a little class locally. It's like, here's how to do video. And you're going to watch a video of Zach King do something. And then someone who's been trained to teach you how to do the thing that Zach King did is now going to walk through it with you. And it's been, you know, obviously they've done it 1,000 times and they probably practiced it 100 times before they were allowed to do it in public. And so there's all these things that, you know, just really, really well Apple-esque designed pieces that keep people coming in. And I think that they've been great. I kind of miss the theaters. A lot of there were theaters in a lot of them that when they got remodeled, they took a lot of the theaters out. We did a Mac break, I think, or at least, or twit in the theater in San Francisco.
We did. And I got all sweaty. I have memories of that. I even have pictures of that. I got all sweaty because I was just me. I ran all the wires, all the cables and stuff. And we were sitting down there. It was great. And we had a whole full crowd in the theater. It was really fun.
It was great because the old San Francisco store was literally across the block from our office.
Right. And so you were friends with Travis, the manager.
Yeah, I spoke well, because I spoke over there like once a month.
Yeah,
because like, you know, it'd be like, oh, it's time to walk over.
I remember sitting in Yerba Buena Center during a keynote, and you would text Travis, hold one of each for me, please.
Yeah.
It's good to have friends.
You know, it does help. Yeah. But I think that I don't know if it was Travis. I think it was someone else there.
Some guy. I don't know.
But it was another person over there that was able to hold it. Things would
I don't know why the name Travis stuck in my memory, but it did.
Yeah, exactly.
I want to shout out to Michael Stieber, who does a Substack all about Apple retail called Tabletops.
Oh.
MichaelStieber.substack.com. And I think he's the one who first noticed the Tyson's Corner thing with the it's like little apple slices, Andy. It's like little apple slices in the six apple.
Oh, it is weird. Yeah, that's that's actually on the thing that we were just describing, which is blocking off view
on the wall.
What they're gonna do?
But Michael is the one who you probably remember he did those sort of 3D walkthroughs where you could see sort of original Apple stores and actually read the things on the shelves and all of that. And he's really proven to be a historian of Apple store lore on top of everything else. It's just I think it's one of the great things about the internet that you find people who are super into a topic and can take it on. And it's rare to have them take it on and do it as well as Michael Stieber has done with his coverage of this stuff.
This is actually, I like this weird slices
Yeah.
Apple. You know, Apple's gotten in the last probably 5 years, Apple's gotten a lot more creative about what they do with their logo. For a long time, it was like the logo is the logo.
Right.
But even some of the pre-shows that you've seen in keynotes where the logo's constantly changing shape and color and everything else, they've definitely kind of played with, been a lot more playful with their brand than they have in the past.
At their Brooklyn event where they, which was 2018, I think, when they did the iPad Pro and the MacBook, one MacBook there. Anyway, they handed out to everybody who attended stickers, and they were all different, but they were all stickers designed by, I don't even know, I think they said who. And they're all the Apple logo, but with different designs on the logo. And I thought that is, I mean, first off, what a move to do that and to have the confidence that your logo can have anything on it as long as it's shaped properly. That they, not only can you put that out publicly and say, yes, this sticker is not a knockoff, Apple made these stickers and handed them out to members of the media with their logo with this weird design on it that came from some artist somewhere, because they can, they just are not worried. They know it all means Apple, and that's the power of that silhouette and also the confidence Apple has with their branding.
This actually started with MTV back in the 80s when MTV got their logo designed. They saw a bunch of different prototypes for it. And they told the design shop, hey, you know what? Let's use them all. Mm. And that actually became a signature element of MTV was, you know, they would have all sorts of artists.
Animations.
And animate these and do all sorts of crazy things with the logo. That was a brilliant move. And I think bravo to Apple, because, you know, Apple's so brand conscious and so protective of their brand. I'm sure their inclination is, oh, don't mess with the Apple.
Well, most companies, most large companies, that's their inclination.
Sure, they have.
Don't mess with
them. Why mess with it?
Right. And
well, I think Apple has raised They're like so far above the bar now that they can. They're like, yeah, we'll do whatever as long as it's the shape.
Right.
Everybody will get it. Everybody knows it.
Right.
And then creativity is part of Apple's brand. So having it be, I mean, step one for Steve Jobs was to take the rainbow away. But then remember, they were individual colors for a while that you could get, even on people's business cards. People could like choose
which
color
green.
They wanted. Yeah. And now they are really leaning into just playing around with it and not being afraid of the rainbow, too, which is somebody who named his site after the 6-color Apple rainbow. I love that they keep bringing it back in playful ways.
Yeah, you should really be the expert, the keeper of this.
I need to start a Substack all about the Apple rainbow.
Yeah. Well, follow, ask Michael how
about it. Go to 6colors.com. It'll be fun.
Maybe, maybe you should sue Apple and to own the trademark, because you're making more use of the rainbow logo than they have.
Uh-oh.
It's an abandoned
one. I took it over.
Nice to stir up the pot there, Mr. AI.
Yeah, good luck.
And good plug for Michael Stieber. Let's plug it again. Michaelstieber.substack.
A lot of good stuff there.
If you're for some reason fascinated by Apple stores, This is the site for you.
I mean, really?
Yeah. Holy cow.
It is, by the way, it is the Apple store in Townsend, Maryland, that voted to unionize. And there's an article in a local Baltimore paper about how the union is now saying that Apple's dragging its feet in negotiations, that they're not really, they're accusing Apple of not negotiating a good faith for a union contract.
Hasn't the NLRB already spanked Amazon and Apple for kind of bad faith in all of this stuff? Starbucks been fighting it too.
Yeah, but this is a different thing. They actually voted to unionize, and so which means that Apple and the union now have about a year to work out a union contract for its workers. And if those negotiations fail, then a judge steps in to lead the negotiations. But they're basically, the union is now saying that contract talks with Apple have been, quote, very, very slow, unquote. Mm. They voted in June.
Ask the Writers Guild of America what to do about that. They've gone out and strike. Alex, are there pickets around the house now, or is it
no pickets?
No pickets.
You're not. No, there's no pickets.
Yeah, all the late night show. This happened in 2007, didn't it? There was a long writers' strike. All the late night shows had to shut down. It was actually, we can credit the birth of reality TV to the last writer guilds.
It was the growth, not the last one.
1981, 1985, 1988, and 2007.
Yeah,
and really what happened was is that at least when we were paying attention to that during the last writer's strike is that if it goes on for a long time, you know, at the beginning, it creates a lot of disruption. If it goes on for a long time, then content creators or the producers start to find other solutions. And so, you know, going in, it happened to be that what was available was unscripted content. And so they were able to, that ramped up and that, you know, changed the industry pretty dramatically. Wow. So we'll see what happens. If this one takes a long time to get to, there's probably going to be new business opportunities for people to build other things that are non-scripted.
And AI is one of the issues. The way the writer's room is being treated is another one of the issues. And of course, I'm always...
It's the streaming dynamic is number one, right?
That's like the real
problem. The way that compensation was defined for writing for television and film was all about... World. Yeah, it was all about traditional output, right? It was all about network TV shows or a Saturday morning kids cartoon show or a cable TV show. And with streaming, the money, all the streamers are terrified and they're cutting their budgets and all that. But the fact is they're very profitable. They're extremely profitable. And they've slashed how many episodes are in a season. It's dramatically impacted the work of the writer. And the Writers Guild is basically saying, we need a contract that takes into account the success of streaming. And right now, you've been getting away with not paying us and not staffing the writers' rooms and treating us like day laborers when we in fact need to be on a contract and we need to be there for a whole season instead of just the days we show up in the room. And all of this is, I mean, I think it's going to be a really bad one because I think the writers have basically said, you've gotten away with profiting on some technological changes in our industry, and that needs to stop because we need to be cut in. And the producers are going to say, well, no, we would like to make lots of money. Like, we want to continue doing that. And, you know, I think it's going to be ugly.
Apple is one of the the signatories that is being picketed.
Yep.
Apple TV.
Sometimes in these cases, you end up having outliers. Apple and Amazon, I would watch them because Apple, sometimes what ends up happening is the companies that do not have the complete vested interest, like if you're a studio, are the ones who cut deals with different terms with the guild. And it ends up being a method of like a strategy, which is these guys will become the model and they'll say yes. Apple and Amazon will say yes. And then we really have more leverage with all the other studios. I'm not saying that'll happen here, but it's possible it will because Apple and Amazon just don't have the market dynamics that HBO and Netflix have because they're not solely an entertainment company. They've got all sorts of other revenue sources. They're playing on a different game.
Yeah. Remember this, what happened with Letterman in 2007, where the show was dark for a while, and then his show reached a separate agreement with the WGA so they can go back.
That's the perfect parallel, right?
And so, if Apple simply says, you know what, we don't really care about, we're not part of those guys, like, hey, WGA, why don't we hammer out an agreement just between you and us? And that becomes a way that Apple gets back into the schedule, that becomes a model for, hey, look, Apple as a group of producers seems to be okay with it. And like Jason said, it's the problem here is that the traditional model has always been like the way the television's been for decades before streaming, where the writers and the producers and the show creators are accepting less money because they know that the payoff could be, hey, look, if we get to 100 episodes, this goes into syndication, it winds up being sold all over the world to different markets, and this becomes something that we make money on for a decade or two to come. With streaming, it's no, we get paid peanuts, and then this does not go into syndication. This basically becomes part of the Amazon library or becomes part of the Netflix streaming library. This doesn't become continually more valuable as it keeps getting sold to different and different markets. So they're basically, that's why they're saying that, hey, look, this whole model has to change. And then AI is going to be a big deal as well. Just the idea that there's already some talk about how they need to have a discussion about whether or not networks are able to basically use chatbots to create or basically enhance to replace people on the writing staff. And it's, I think Jason's right. I think this could be super, super ugly.
Adam Conover, who is in the WGA, Adam Ruins Everything, was one of his shows, posted the offers and the counter offers. In the AI, the WGA, the Writers Guild, proposed to regulate use of artificial intelligence on MBA-covered projects. AI cannot write or rewrite literary material, can't be used as source material, and MBA-covered material can't be used to train AI, which is interesting, to which the AMPTP, which is negotiating on behalf of the producers, said, what about an annual meeting to discuss advancements in technology? How would you feel about that? Adam says, an insulting counter just dripping with contempt. Mm-hmm. We could talk about it once a year.
We'll teach you. And it really feels like, oh, we'll teach you what's really possible there. We'll learn you up about this, you writers.
I think writers should be worried. I mean, that's a reasonable thing for, I mean, what they just described here, that would be terrifying.
Also, imagine things like, oh, we just had the AI whip up some story ideas. Now, yeah, right now, what put do this you into think? A script.
Yeah, just like, yeah, give us a script.
No.
Well, and you could definitely see, I mean, I was my daughter had asked about the theory of special relativity, and I told ChatGPT, I said, explain special relativity as if I was Richard Feynman talking to an 11-year-old. And it started off with, okay, kiddo. Which is very, it immediately leaned into it, and I was like, yeah. Wow. And I, as someone who read lectures on physics, right, when I was a kid, when it described it, sounded like it was the voice of Richard Feynman, you know, like it was written in that voice. And so I could see how when you're writing something, you could say, well, this is what I want to say, but rewrite that all in the voice of JFK or in the voice of this a gangster. And it would just kind of refine that into something. And, you know, I can see why producers would resist that, because there's an opportunity there to possibably do things that are, you know, that a lot, because there's a lot of times when you're watching a TV show and I'm like, they spent a lot of money, you know, on this TV show, and the writing sometimes it's great, but not all the time. Like a lot of times the dialogue is like, no one in that business would ever say that in that way, you know? And so you're like, and it's a writer that's writing outside of their core competency. They don't know how people would talk that way, and they didn't have time to go through that. And so I think that there is, there are places where it could make a difference. It's one thing to figure out what it should start to look like, but saying that we can't use it ever for, you know, anything that's there doesn't necessarily make a better product.
I want our podcast writers covered by the WGA. I mean, asking for a friend. We don't have writers, so we're safe. Emily St. James, who does write for podcasts, did tweet, thank you, Scooter X, that that's a common mistake to assume that the last writer's strike started reality TV. She points out The Apprentice is older than the writer's strike 2004. Mm-hmm. Actually, even before that, Big Brother. But I think it did accelerate
it. It definitely accelerated it.
Yeah. Wasn't That's Incredible, like, started by the writer's strike?
Oh, in 1998 or whatever?
No, in the early
1981.
Yeah.
I love that show. There was a huge fight back then. Remember, when we had one television, and it was Little House. My sister wanted to watch Little House on the Prairie, but it was at the same time as That's Incredible. And there was a lot of stress there. I put another antenna on the roof so that I could watch That's Incredible.
And that's the origin story of Alex Lindsay.
Yeah. He put an antenna on the roof.
Another one.
Wow.
So, yeah.
She says it's just the big entertainment corporations want you to think that, because that's the threat, right? Hey, we don't need writers.
Yeah. When you argue that people just watch stuff that's not scripted, I mean, you're doing their work for them.
Right.
You do that. And the fact is that entertainment is a mix of stuff. But I've always admired, I remember back, Andy will remember this too, back in 87, 88, when they did the writer's strike, and David Letterman and Johnny Carson both came back on the air and they wrote their own jokes. And the whole point was not to undermine the writers. The point was to show how they were without professional writers. And they did Hal Gurney's Network Time Killers, which is a wonderful, again, showing we could have written material here, but instead our director is going to do stupid things. And they were funny and brilliant, but it was satire, because they were basically saying, look what life is like without professional writers. So let's not fool ourselves. You can't, AI is not going to do it. Reality shows aren't going to do it. They will do some things, but you need the professionals. They're the ones who they are the ones who write the words and come up with the scenarios for the TV shows you love.
And again,
they should get paid.
I think
the Letterman show for the,
I was going to say, I don't think ChatGPT is going to replace any writers. I'm just saying that the say that you can't use ChatGPT to try to find a voice for a specific character, you know, that might make it, you know, that might be more realistic.
But I don't think the Writers Guild is saying you can't. They're just saying we want some terms,
rules. We got some about rules about what it can be used for.
But the danger is like you have a show like The Simpsons, which is in 34 seasons. That means that you have 34 seasons worth of scripts of Homer Simpson dialogue, Bart Simpson dialogue. Bart Simpson dialogue. Once you basically fine tune a chat model for here's exactly how Homer Simpson talks. Yeah. Exactly. It's just like any conversation you have with ChatGPT. It's not something that you would put right into production you could get to a first draft really, really quickly. And so you get from hiring a writer's room of like 8 or 9 people to ChatGPT, basically one head writer comes up with 10 springboards, ChatGPT gives you a rough outline, then it's assigned to one of 4 people, you know.
And that's one of the specific things that the WGA is negotiating is using our writing as training for a chat. And boy, when you say it that way, you're absolutely right. That's not a good use of that. Yeah. Well, we'll watch with interest. And you're right. Apple will make a deal. Scooter X also sent me a link. Which I wish I had been able to go down and see this. Apple apparently does candlelight performances in the Apple store that is the old movie theater down in L.A. This one was April 30th, sold out. And it looks beautiful. They put, they've done a tribute to Coldplay. These candlelight performances are gorgeous. And they put candles all around the performers. They did the Four Seasons. They did a little Mozart on a Kleine Nacht music. They did some Eleanor Rigby, a little Bohemian Rhapsody, Bach's Cello Suite Number 1, the theme from the Game of Thrones, the theme from Inception, the theme from Back to the Future, Destiny's Child, Say My Name, Anti-Hero by Taylor Swift, and then About Damn Time from Lizzo. I don't know how I guess it's a chamber music group. I don't know how that would sound, but it might be cool. And then they close with Swan Lake. It's the Orchid Quartet. Man, I would have loved to have seen that. And good for Apple for doing that. You know, that was to celebrate the release of classical Apple Music Classic. Mm-hmm.
One of the things I really appreciate about what Apple does with its higher end stores is that it takes these public spaces, like these huge banks and these huge like museums, these huge theaters, those would be landmarks in any neighborhood or any city that would ordinarily be turned into condos or office spaces or torn down for one or the other. And they're preserving it as a public space.
Yeah, look at this.
It's an Apple store, but it's still a place where anybody can come in and enjoy this space.
This is the Tower Theater store, and they preserved it as a theater as well as an Apple store. And man, I would have loved to have seen this, huh? Wow.
Yeah.
That's really, really cool. Apple Pay was down briefly. In fact, all Apple services from Apple Cash to Apple Card down briefly a couple of days ago on Wednesday. Gosh, I hope that doesn't happen too often because I really depend on this. You basically use Apple Pay for everything now. Everything's green right now on the system status page. But you see here, resolved issue Apple Card, resolved issue Apple Cash, resolved issue Apple Pay and Wallet. So.
Imagine if like Bank of America or Citibank basically said, I know you want to withdraw some money right now. I know you're supposed to be paying a bill right now, but yeah, we're down. But hey, keep checking back. We'll probably be back up again in an hour or two.
I mean, I've been to the ATM where it said, sorry,
out of money.
ATM is out of service. Right. And it's like, okay.
Used to be, gosh,
it does happen.
Way back in the day. You'd go up to the ATM and somebody'd be pulling it out of the thing and they'd put a card there that says out of service as they're restocking it. That doesn't happen anymore. But boy, I remember those? Maybe that's just
we had one across from my school where they came in with a forklift and they stole one.
ATM.
They like picked the whole thing up and threw it in the forklift.
That's pretty gutsy. I gotta say, that's chutzpah.
They were really excited for about a day and a half. You shouldn't borrow your friend's truck when you do that.
That's oh, really? They got caught. Okay, good.
Yeah. They found blank slips. He saw the news. He saw blank slips of an ATM
in the truck.
In the behind the seat, they like shoved him back there. I guess a couple of them had gotten out. Dopes. And he just called the police. He was like, dopes. My friend's borrowed my truck. It's dented. Dopes. It's dented and there's blank.
What dopes. You know,
ATMs. Yeah.
Apple's savings account did quite well. According to Forbes, in day one, nearly $1 billion in deposits. In day one, $400 million in deposits. I was one of them. Turn it on the minute I could.
I think that Apple, what they're doing really well is they're mixing ease of use and interface with a reasonable interest rate. And I think that the other folks that are doing this, there are people with higher interest rates, but they don't have the ease of use. And then almost nobody has the same ease of use. And then so then they're competing only for percentages. And I don't think they're getting, it's a good percentage. It's not the best percentage, but
it's pretty close to the best. There are only a couple of banks that give you better. And convenience. Although I did see somebody probably working for a big bank, but say, well, it's way too easy to get the money out of the savings account. It's way too easy to spend it. You know, you should put it somewhere where you can't access it so easily, like our bank.
yeah, exactly.
It's just too convenient.
This should frighten banks a lot. Especially little ones. Like if you're in a big bank and you have a big reason to do it, but if you're a smaller bank and you're trying to do retail, savings accounts, it doesn't affect everybody because not everybody can open.
You have to have an Apple card.
Apple card holder. Yeah.
Yeah. And even then, I have an Apple card. I had one for a long time, but even then I had to kind of go apply, but it was pretty quick. I mean, I did it in, one session. The nice thing is, for Apple, and I guess for me too, because I get daily Apple Cash from my purchases every day, a couple of bucks going in there. It makes me want to buy more stuff now. You know, when I get my bagel once a week, I buy it with an Apple card. When we go to the grocery store, I say, honey, I'll buy the groceries, and I buy it with my Apple Watch. It's convenient for me. A little bit of money goes into that savings account. That's smart on Apple's part. That really makes the Apple Watch and the Apple phone very powerful.
Go ahead, Andy. One of the things I was really thinking about related to Apple and also just related to a lot of other businesses is a lot of businesses, you get into conversations of how do we get the consumer to do X, Y, and Z? Like their whole thing is like, how do we funnel them in and get them to do what we want them to do? And I think Apple spends more time thinking about how do we surprise and delight them, and knowing that will lead to things in the future that are better. And I think that it's just a different mindset. And I think Apple's not the only company that does that, but I think the companies that think about how do we make this a great experience as opposed to how do we extract what we want out of the consumer. I think those are two different mindsets, and they both can yield the same thing. But a lot of times I think that the first mindset is a lot more effective.
Forbes article points out that, of course, the savings account is through Goldman Sachs, which is Apple's partner, and the Apple Card as well. And Goldman Sachs has its own high yield savings account under its consumer brand Marcus, but it's only 3.9%. So now Goldman, remember, was complaining that they lost $1 billion with the Apple Card and all that stuff. Maybe they're happy, a little happier now with that $1 billion coming back into their fold. According to
acquisition.
By the end of the launch week, 240,000 accounts had been opened. One source added, that's 240,000 new customers for Goldman. Really? If you think about it
again, cost of acquisition of new customers is pretty good.
Yeah. Those Goldman executives looking better.
Yeah, you just have to share you have to subsume your brand to Apple. I think that probably hurts, but
people know. I think it says Goldman in a few places. It's not, with the failure of the First Republic this week, I'm sure there's a little chill going up and down the spine of smaller banks. Chase is probably saying, "Why didn't we do that deal with Apple? Why did you say no to them?"
Well, and you also have to put up with Apple's requests or their demands for what that looks like. But that, didn't hurt AT&T too much.
Yeah, it's always
like
seemed
they didn't
to be,
like it.
Yeah.
Because they were.
Verizon didn't want to do it. Now they realize maybe they should have. Yeah.
I mean, a lot of times, a lot of these companies are being, again, they're not customer focused.
Right. You
know, they're very like, there's like, how do we, like, I got this package the other day. It was repackaged as it's chlorine from my pool. Same company, new brand. And it's just a little harder to open. Like, it's just a little harder to open. And I know what they did. They found a cheaper way to make that bottle.
Yeah.
Like, you know, they rebranded it
about you. Way.
And I was like, they didn't look at like, how do we make it better? They figured out how do we save literally probably a quarter of a penny on that thing. And the funny thing is that I don't even know how much that chlorine costs. I literally don't know if they just charged more and had the top work better. But you see that all the time with companies that they're figuring out let's figure out how to shave a quarter cent off, or let's figure out how to. And I think that they think that that's the best way to run their business. And I think that a lot of times they're wrong.
And by the way,
people will pay more if it's just great.
We have now an episode of The Simpsons written by ChatGPT where Homer is invited to be a guest on the show. Interior, fade in, Simpsons living room day. Homer is lounging on the couch, flipping through TV channels, sighing, nothing good on TV today. Suddenly the phone rings. Homer picks it up. Hello?
Hi, is this Homer Simpson?
Yes, it is.
This is Leo Laporte from MacBreak Weekly. Oh, I didn't know that was...
You should do Homer's voice.
We're big fans of our website, The Homer Simpson Show.
You're kidding!
Nope. We'd love to have you on our show as a guest.
Oh my God, I can't believe it. When do you want me to come on?
Next week. We'll send a car to pick you up.
This
no questions.
Is the best day of my life. Grinning ear to ear, Homer arrives at the studio in a fancy car.
You want to be Leo Laporte?
Yeah, I'll be Leo now. He walks in the studio and is greeted by Leo Laporte. Homer, it's great to meet you in person. We're so excited to have you on the show.
I'm excited too, Leo. This is a dream come true.
You're much better. Much better at Homer. Well, let's get started. We're going to talk about the latest Apple products and news. Homer nods enthusiastically. So, Homer, what's your favorite Apple product?
Oh, that's easy. It's my trusty iPhone. I use it for everything.
Leo nods in agreement.
When this is animated, it's going to be a lot funnier.
A lot funnier. And add the laugh track, if you would. And what do you think, Homer, of the new MacBook Pro?
It's amazing. I saw it on the Apple website, and I really want one.
I think we all want one, Homer. It's a great machine. They continue to talk about the latest Apple news and products.
Yes.
Homer, sharing his opinions
script
and insights.
Passes out from boredom at this point.
Cut to Simpsons Living Room Night.
Striking writers are in a very good position right now.
Homer is sitting on the couch with his family, watching himself on TV.
Can you believe it? I was on MacBreak Weekly.
We're so proud.
We're so proud of you.
We're so proud of you, Homer.
Does this mean you're going to switch to a MacBook Pro, man?
You can't do all the voices.
I can't do all the voices.
What do you think you are, Hank Azaria?
Really?
I wish, son, but for now, my iPhone will have to do.
AI.
Thank you, AI.
We support the writers.
Now you weren't paying the $20 for the GPT-4, were you?
I don't know. Patrick, were you paying for GPT-4 on that one? I don't know. Patrick's telehandy.
The tell with AI written stuff is it's all like super enthusiastic and reads like it's PR talking points about literally anything.
But we can fix that.
We'll train a new model.
You know, maybe we can sell it to Family Guy. I don't think that would be out of place on a Family Guy.
No one would know.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we will talk about Apple's struggles with AI, according to Wayne Ma, writing for the Information. Apple maybe not as well positioned as we might have thought. But first, a word from our sponsor. When you see the studio, when you see our shows, you probably noticed we are in the Twit Eastside Studios, brought to you by ACI Learning. And you might say, well, who's ACI Learning when they're at home? Well, you, I'm sure, know the name IT Pro. IT Pro TV was with us since their very inception. Last year, ACI Learning and IT Pro merged to form a new group of that can give you the IT training you've been looking for to level up your career or to level up your organization. IT Pro, now part of ACI Learning. With IT Pro, ACI Learning expands its reach, adds those great studios in Gainesville you just saw, that can produce new content every day, all day. They do 5 days a week. They're doing it Monday through Friday. So you can get the content, fresh content you need to advance your IT career at any stage of your development. For example, one of the most widely
recognized beginner certs, the one a lot of people start with, the A-plus cert from CompTIA. CompTIA courses with IT Pro from ACI Learning make it easy to go from daydreaming about a career in IT to launching it. Earning certs opens the door and is, in fact, a requirement of many entry-level IT positions. Supplies potential promotions if you're already in the IT field and you want to get a better job or get promoted. And the thing that's important to understand is not just the knowledge, because a cert shows you have the knowledge, but it's also you had the gumption. You went and you studied and you learned and you took the test and you advanced yourself. And I think employers are very impressed by those certs. They really are. Tech is one industry where opportunities outpace growth, especially cybersecurity. There's a lot of demand for talent, and there are not enough people to fill those jobs. And about a third of information security jobs actually require a cybersecurity cert. In fact, 23% of all IT jobs require a cert. While organizations are hungry for cybersecurity talent, that cyber skills gap is growing, and that's why pay is also growing. If you're tired of being in the Writers Guild, maybe you should consider becoming a cybersecurity specialist. Average salary, $116,000. ACI Learning's information security analyst and cybersecurity specialist programs can get you that cert. Those certs, the certs you need. ACI Learning offers multiple cybersecurity training programs to prepare you to enter, or if you're already in it, advance. CISSP, there's the Certified Ethical Hacker certs, Certified Network Defender, Cybersecurity Audit School. Audit is very important these days for compliance, and cybersecurity frameworks. Those are among the most popular cybersecurity certs, but they've got them all. Here's what you got to do. You've got to explore everything ACI Learning offers, because it is expanded now, including IT Pro, but also Audit Pro. Practice Labs have expanded. They've got learning hubs, too, for people who want to learn in person. And, of course, their partnership program. If you've got a team that you want to upskill, for teams from 2 to 1,000, volume discounts start at 5 seats, and there's even a free 2-week trial. For training for your team. That's enough time to take a whole course and get some sense of what this could do for you. All of IT Pro ACI Learning's courses are chunked up into 20 to 30 minutes, so it's easy to take during a break, during a lunch hour. It's easy to assign, and one of the team platform lets you do this, assign just an individual episode of a course. Every one of these episodes has a full transcript. A lot of people like to read along. There's different kinds of learnings. People like to watch. Some people like to get hands-on. Those practice labs help. Some people like to learn in person. And thanks to ACI Learning, now we've got them all. This Thursday, not this Thursday, I guess it's a couple of weeks off. Thursday, May 18th. Yeah, that's 2 weeks away. 2 p.m. Eastern, the All Things Cybersecurity webinar. Special guest Naomi Buckwalter. She's the director of product security for Contrast Security and the founder and executive director of the Cybersecurity Gatebreakers Foundation. Particularly of interest if you're a woman, you want to get into cybersecurity. Naomi's got a lot of great advice and a lot of information. You'll learn what it takes to be a security architect. Guys, too, of course. Tips for advancing your cybersecurity career and how to bridge the knowledge gap in cybersecurity. That's free. If you can't be there in person, it's nice to be there in person Thursday, May 18th, 2 p.m. Eastern, because then you can ask questions, but they'll make it available for watching later, so you can watch it later too. This is what's great about ACI Learning, transforming how companies train and technology professionals learn to fuel the modern workforce. For premium training in audit, IT, and cybersecurity readiness, visit the website go.acilearning.com/twit. Premium training, but not a premium cost. go.acilearning.com/twit. In fact, we're going to make it even more affordable. If you're an individual looking for a standard or premium membership, 30% off. Just use the offer code TWIT30, TWIT30. go.acilearning.com/twit. We thank you so much. We love IT Pro. We love those guys, the founders. We are so happy for them when they joined with ACI Learning. We're happy to have ACI Learning as studio sponsors and they really support all of our shows. You help us, though, if you use that special code TWIT30 for 30% off standard or premium individual training. And, of course, go.acilearning.com/twit. Thank you, ACI Learning. Thank you. Wayne Mahu's pretty well connected. I think he does a good job. He works for the information. It's one of the reasons I spend a lot of money for an information account. Late last year, he writes, a trio of engineers who helped Apple modernizes search technology, began working on a large language model.
the type of technology underlying ChatGPT. For Apple, there was only one problem. The engineers no longer work there. They left the company to work on the technology at Google. Whoops. Srinivasan Venkachari, Stephen Baker, Anand Shukla left Apple last fall because they thought, well, if we're going to work on large language models, Google's the place to be. Yikes. Google actually wanted them so badly, Wayne says, that Sundar Pichai personally wooed them. Mm-hmm. But then again, Tim Cook tried to persuade him to stay. Must be nice.
This is a fascinating story, and since you paid for the information, I can't wait for Uncle Leo to tell us more. But because
they've got a source, two people who spoke to Venkatachari about it, so they got it from the horse.
Oh yeah, no, this is good stuff. My initial reaction to this story was I totally understand why those guys would do that, because I feel like Apple. The story here is this push and pull between wanting to be out on the cutting edge and wanting to be seen as being out on the cutting edge, and Apple basically keeping everything inside the black box right until they announce something. And when you look at all the missteps out there with AI stuff, where it's been an embarrassment for whoever launches whatever model. In fact, the brilliant thing about inventing OpenAI is that Microsoft can fund it, but it's not Microsoft whose chatbot is saying terrible things this time. Previously it was, this time it's not. And so if I was somebody working on this stuff inside Apple and was really excited and got told at every turn, well, we can't make it public. We can't do that. Your work can't be public because it's going to make things up and people want Siri to not make things up. I would think about going to Google, yeah, right? I totally understand.
There's also the check. Yep. And maybe Google was willing to write a larger check. I mean, these guys, I've heard stories. They're making more than $1 million a year. These guys are
very horrible.
Hot commodity.
Commodity. Sure. Of course, remember, Apple did hire John Giandrea away from Google. Yes. He is the guy and he's still there. But Wayne writes, according to interviews with more than three dozen, Wayne's been busy, three dozen former Apple employees who worked in its AI and machine learning groups. Organizational dysfunction and a lack of ambition have bogged down those efforts, including the work of the group responsible for Siri. At one point, when they were working on the mixed reality headset, Mike Rockwell expressed disappointment in the demonstrations. This is, again, Wayne's reporting. The Siri team created to showcase the voice assistant working with the headset and even considered, maybe we should write our own voice commands. Ooh, ow.
You can see it, right? I mean, I totally can see it.
Yeah.
He does say the headset team ultimately ditched that idea.
Mm-hmm.
And Wayne does point out Apple is still the most valuable company in the world.
Well, and I think there's a lot of good points and discussion here, but I will point out that, as he points out, his source is people who left.
Right.
Those are people who were probably not happy being at Apple and chose to go elsewhere. His sources aren't the people who stayed at Apple and are working on this stuff now. So just take it with a grain of salt.
But the people who stayed are never going to talk.
Well, I mean, you can't get those people to talk. I get that, but I'm just saying.
And the people who left for a reason, and this is what they're saying.
And this is what they're saying. That's right, but you're only getting the people who left. And I think that, I think it's always worth asking yourself, why are these people talking? And in this case, I think it's because they were frustrated and they quit.
Yeah.
Well,
or they're frustrated by the way it's structured, or as we said earlier, frustrated by the fact that Apple keeps everything in a big black box, and nobody can look at it. Nobody can know what you're working on. And every one of their colleagues who's out at OpenAI or at Google or, wherever they are shipping stuff, and it's really a hot category. And then you're working at Apple, and not only are they telling you sort of like no to a lot of things, but you can't even admit to what you're doing. Like, right. There are lots of reasons to not be there anymore.
There's also the issue we've talked about many times, and Wayne brings this up as well, of Apple being uncompromising on privacy, which to some degree hampers its ability. I mean, ChatGPT is getting in all sorts of trouble. The Italian regulator shut him down for a few weeks because of the issue of privacy. Samsung has told its
employees, you can't use ChatGPT because it might you might be leaking inadvertently private company information. That's a serious concern. And so Apple, you know, this is, you know, a problem for Apple. They don't want to do that. I understand why.
I think the problem is, especially if you're a developer, I mean, if you're a researcher and you're excited about AI, the problem that you have is the two things that oppose each other is doing the right thing all the time and developing some of these AI, these large language models, because what makes them cool and what makes them super effective is breaking all kinds of rules. Like, you know, it's, you know, and so they're really effective because they just did it and they just threw it out there. You know, OpenAI made it really, really fun, and it creates ChatGPT is a really fun, you know, thing that I use every day. And I know that it would be half as cool if they had tried to dot every I and cross every T. And the problem is that if you're at Apple, they don't want to do anything that's going to break any, you know, rules or hedge anything or hurt the brand or do anything else. And so as an AI researcher, you're going to often feel like you're kind of tied up. And I think that's a really hard place for a lot of those, you know, AI researchers to be in any of these models that are trying to do it the right way is that, you know, it's, well, the cool kids are over there and they're doing this crazy thing and everyone loves them. And we're stuck with this thing that isn't going to work as well because we're doing the right thing. And that's, I think it's a really hard place. It's a hard way to keep developers in the fold.
According to the information, yeah. John Giandrea, who they call JG, thank goodness. So I'm going to call him that from now on. JG was hired because the Siri group in 2018 was in disarray and he was brought in to kind of reorganize it. This is Wayne Ma writing. He soon brought changes to Apple from his leadership style to policy shifts. People who worked with Giandrea describe him as charismatic, though soft-spoken, a tinkerer in his spare time. One of his hobbies is disassembling atomic clocks. With a sharp contrast to the type A personalities in Apple's senior ranks, where it's common for executives to take over meetings and eviscerate rank and file employees who come unprepared, according to former Siri employees. However, he increased salaries, which had been lower than those of rivals, brought in many people he worked with at Google. He helped acquire Laserlike, a startup, which brought Venka, Cherry Baker, and Shukla to Apple, $155 million acquisition. However, it sounds like he hasn't been able to keep the team on track on purpose. Maybe he's thwarted by Apple's own upper management. Under Giandrea, Apple also acquired other AR startups. However, founders and employees of these startups in several cases, including the one we just referred to, ended up leaving Apple. Often departures occurred. Oh, there's the smoking gun. After their stock grants vested.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Some of these people told the information. Another factor was that Apple was too slow to make decisions or too conservative in its approach to new AI technologies, such as.
Show me the lie.
Large language models. Yeah. Yeah. It's a good long article. It's an interesting question. I understand Apple's reluctance to go whole hog on a technology that is frankly somewhat embarrassing right now for Microsoft and Google.
We can't necessarily give Apple the benefit of the doubt. That's one possibility that they're being very, very cautious about doing the most safe and cautious thing, particularly as regards to individual privacy. It's possible that they're just gutless. It's possible they just have no vision for this. It's possible that they're just not interested in this. And
I'll give you more data from the Wayne Ma article. This is one more piece. And it kind of is interesting because remember we've talked before about how the design team at Apple seemed to have an unusual amount of clout. Around 2019, engineers working on the Siri feature, you remember when you asked Siri for something, she says, here's what I found on the web. They were working on a feature that used material from the web to answer questions, but there was a clash over how accurate the responses needed to be before they could release the feature. The Siri design team wanted it to be perfect. The engineers said, hey, 80% should be good enough. Engineers also spent months persuading Siri designers that not every one of its answers required human verification, a limitation that would make it impossible to scale up Siri A year later, the design team did back off the rule, but they had to back off before the engineers could win that argument. The design team's high standards frustrated some of Apple's machine learning engineers, who argued, look, these models are bound to make mistakes. The only way to improve them, by the way, this is Microsoft and Google's philosophy, is to release them into the wild and tweak them gradually. That went against the culture of Apple's design teams, known for telling engineers to wait several years to perfect a product before releasing it. It all makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, but the other thing is that, like, Steve Jobs' famous pitch was never, you know, come. His famous pitch was, you want to join me and help change the world. It's never, you want to join me and help work out some of the bugs we have in our USB 4 protocol stack. And when you have someone who is at the edge of artificial intelligence research, and you're telling them that, hey, this is the most exciting time for people who are in your line of work. We really want you to focus on palm rejection for the new iPad. Like, well, no, that's not going to really interest them. That's not going to intrigue them. And also, the fact that they were able to leave so easily, I think that also bespeaks the fact that Google has been actually working on this for 3, 4, 5, close to 10 years. The only reason why they're doing something as public as Bard is because OpenAI sort of like forced their hand to at least have something out there that they're clearly they're labeling the hell of it as experimental. They're saying, you're helping us to develop this. We're not giving you a tool that's actually productive or trustworthy for anything. They're annotating every step of the way. I mean, everyone's talking today about Jeffrey Hinton leaving Google and talking about his concerns about the czar of artificial intelligence at Google, and how he's leaving basically so he could speak more openly about his concerns about the platform. But even he is saying that Google is being very, very cautious and being very as responsible as can be, certainly more responsible as OpenAI. So, I mean, we can there the possible answer here is that Apple is being responsible and cautious, and they don't want to release anything or even admit that they're working on something until they can show off something that's perfect. But the other thing is that they just don't understand that this is not how large language models work. This is not how the best of artificial intelligence is going to work. I mean, today, during the show, Google announced an improvement they're making to Google Photos, where they already have been kicking butt in automatically recognizing objects in photos and tagging things so that you can basically find anything with a keyword. Now they're basically adding a level of abstraction to your query. So you can say, give me sort of summary looking pictures of water, or give me vacation-y sort of items that are kind of melancholy in nature, which help you find exactly what you're looking for when you don't know exactly what you're looking for. This is an outreach of all the AI work that they've been doing for, again, 3, 4, 5 to 10 years. We're not seeing that from Apple. I mean, Siri, it's embarrassing. We all know how bad Siri is.
Well,
that it's basically functional, but it doesn't really go on someplace.
I'll just close
by saying that, like, if everyone who saw Ted Lasso this week, where there's a, of course, Siri gets a scene in which Nate, like, says, hey, Shlomo, how can you tell if a woman is really interested in you or if she's being nice? Then Siri says, you can't. And everybody who's used Siri say that would not be what Siri would say. Sir, Siri would say,
let me tell you what I found on the web about the internet.
Yeah. Or they'd have one of the team of 20 writers do it. No, Andy, when you talk about something like Apple and AI and use Photos as an example, though, Photos is actually an example of Apple using AI well. Apple has used machine learning models for the last like 4 or 5 years in the Photos app.
On phone.
And it does a pretty good job.
On device.
It needs to be better. And what Google is introducing today sounds really good. And it's like they up the stakes for what Apple needs to do. But that's been a place where Apple actually has used machine learning to the benefit. A lot of things involving iPhone photography, it's done that. The problem is that then meanwhile, Siri is sitting there with its 20 writers. Talk about a writer's strike. Oh, to be on the staff for Siri. Woo!
So Siri uses humans to write its responses.
I think they look at the most common questions and they have humans writing templates and things for them. And I think that's part of the issue here. But this is what I wanted to say is they are using it in certain places, but Siri, to get to Andy's point about are they being conservative or are they being scared, I think the answer is you have to ask them, what happened to real artist ship? Like, at some point, just like with this headset, at some point you just got to get out there and you got to see what happens. And are they behind or are they afraid? I wonder if their fear is actually masking them being too far behind.
It's a really
There is nothing stopping them other than maybe that it's bad from putting Siri 2 out there as a beta with a switch that's off by default. And then everybody can try it and we can learn and we can say this was a stupid answer. Yeah. But they haven't let it out at all.
Actually, and I'm saving you $400 here. In this information article, there is that exact example. Jen Andrea and Venka Cicheri proposed creating a button that allowed users to report a concern or an issue with the content of an answer. Siri's design team had rejected that because they wanted to maintain the image that Siri was all knowing.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, that bird has flown.
We know that's not the case, don't we? Yes.
And by the way, you're right about Siri people having writing responses for Siri. I actually had to try that question like the night that I watched.
Did you try it?
It gave me that lame like vague thing. But then I just tried it today, and it says, "Oh, wunderkind, when will you ever learn?"
You would say, okay, that's clearly a human, right?
Yeah. That's exactly.
Clearly a human.
Pre-baked Ted Lasso.
So they got a writer's room for Siri.
They do.
Wow.
They do. Oh, to be a fly on the wall of the Siri writer's room.
Do you think some of the many people Siri, Apple has stolen from us, are working in that writer's room? Serenity called.
I just wonder who's the job listings for that.
I just wonder who's around Siri. How do you, there's like 8 responses to open the
pod bay door.
The pod bay doors.
Yeah.
There's like 8 different ones. If you keep on asking, Siri will keep on telling you. And I always think about that as I wonder, like, how do they decide what those were going to be?
That's in a nutshell. That's exactly what we're talking about, which is they would prefer to have a clever, well-written, canned response than actual AI in Siri.
It's about control. Yes.
And
it's brand reputation. And I understand that.
Yeah. Yeah, but they risk Google getting behind because of it. Like, I mean, that's the conundrum here. That's why I think that you can look at the story and take like 15 different things away from it. Because is it true that Apple is very conservative about this stuff? Yes. Are they right to be? Well, you could argue that they are, but at the same time, shouldn't they ship something? And if you're somebody who's working on AI inside Apple, is it the best place to be if you want to be a star and get paid a lot of money? Probably not. If you want to show off your work, probably not. Yeah. If you're Tim Cook, do you say, I'm okay with releasing a new version of Siri that gets that hallucinates or that gets stuff wrong and is going to make us the butt of jokes? Or would I rather just be behind? I can see both arguments.
It's not just that. It's not just that. I mean, we can't hyperfixate on ChatGPT and chatbots. This is also use of large language models is also stuff like what's coming to Microsoft Office and the Google Work Suite about saying that, hey, here is 1,000 elements here, 1,000 user responses to a survey we did on something. I want you to analyze each one of these 1,000 responses. And in the next cell of the spreadsheet, summarize whether this is positive or negative. I want you to look at everything that's in this mailbox and show me all of the emails in which that have to do with my schedule on this specific project. It really is about, and Google has been prioritizing artificial intelligence for about 10 years now. So it's not just chatbots. It really is this idea of this large language these large language models that they can really bake into almost everything now. So it's not just a simple as, hey, I recognize a cat in this picture. It really is that, okay, is the cat happy or sad? Is the cat, is it someone who's chasing a cat? Is the cat in danger? Is this an old cat or a young cat? And describe this picture for me in one sentence or two. So these are basically integral features that could be used to enhance almost anything that you do on this device. And I just hope that as Mac users and as iPhone users and iPad users, we don't miss out on this sort of stuff.
I think there's also a possibility that we might say, in a year, oh, it's good Apple didn't fall for that BS. Right? That was just a game, a trick,
Apple has skipped some of those. You know, they've skipped over those, but it is also a different company than the company that ran an ad that said rip mix burn, or it's
yes,
you know, like it, you know, that was a different,
say that again, say what? Rick Nix burn? What?
Rip Mix Burn.
Rip Mix Burn. That was the rip, you're going to tell us to
burn. That was the ad for the iPod, right?
They were like
it was Digital Hub, iTunes, and burning and replaying, and yeah. It was they were accused of that, of being, you know, piracy when they were saying something else. But it was a very bold move, right? And I think that's Alex's point, is now Alex, they do have more to protect now.
Exactly. No, and they had to break into that market, and they did what they needed to do that. And here they're protecting their position, and they have lots of partners, and they have lots of things, and they have a brand to protect, and they have, you know, business models, and their partners have business models. And so it's just a much, much more complicated thing. I'm just saying it's not that Apple never did that. It's just that they stopped doing that at some point, a decade ago.
It's interesting. So, this Rip Mix Burn ad, I think that's the Tower Theater in Los Angeles that Apple later turned into its store. Isn't it? Doesn't it look that way? I'm looking at the old ad. This is from 2001. I think that's the Tower Theater.
They assimilated it.
It didn't help that they had a guy in a hoodie ripping, mixing, and burning.
Yeah, but he's got Liz Phair on stage, right? He's getting all his favorite artists together.
We brought the light bulbs together.
And the wall sconces.
I wonder if it's Siri. I mean, Apple. First off, Siri doesn't even have a definition. Like, it's whatever Apple says it is. It's like they say shortcuts are Siri, and the voice assistant is Siri, and the intelligence that says you might be driving to this location is Siri. They've wrapped it in a bunch of things, even though so many of us think of it as the voice assistant. And as I said before to Andy, like, Apple's got places where their machine learning stuff is actually very good, but it's not in all these other places, and it certainly doesn't seem to be anywhere attached to Siri. And I think we keep coming back to the fact that Siri doesn't work very well. They were ahead at the start, and then they fell behind, and it's inconsistent. And the one thing that I keep looking at in these chatbots is when you attach a chatbot to some good data sources and tell it to search for the answer, they actually don't do so much hallucinating. They actually do a good job, and you think that would be great for Siri. It's funny now that almost the failings of Siri have poisoned us to all the places where Apple actually, or is it that everybody else is like the headset team and is like saying, we got to work around Siri.
Yeah.
We want to avoid Siri because Siri is a mess. Because like whoever's doing the Photos app has spent a lot of time training Photos to use machine learning. But then there's Siri, and like the trouble with Siri.
I mean, again, this is, I've worked in a lot of big companies as a consultant, and this is a very common story.
Yeah.
This is like every big company, you know, and every medium size, every company, sometimes maybe potentially every company that has more than 30 or 40 employees has this thing where there's dysfunction and there's things and there's, you know, things that are working, things that aren't working. There's some manager that's holding everything up. There's some team that does stupid things. There's, you know, and it's just, that's what happens when you get a bunch of human beings in a company that's trying to make money and trying to figure it all out. And so we can go into this, but like a lot of companies have dysfunction. When someone says, oh, that company was dysfunctional, that team was, it was like, okay, well
that
there are dysfunctional teams.
Yeah. It's also, I mean, yeah. Who knows what's going on here? It's hard to say what happens, but it's hard to be a change agent at a company. And John Gianandrea is one of those people who I think was intended to be a change agent about Siri and about machine learning in general. But, you know, Alex, you've probably seen this. I've certainly seen this. You get somebody brought in and they're like, I got big ideas. We're going to make changes. We're going to solve this. And then they say, okay, here are my ideas. They get hired. They get brought in. They say, here are my ideas. We're going to change it. And they're like, idea one. And the people in charge are like,
can't do that.
You can't do that.
It's worse than
idea
that.
Idea two, it, you know, you can't do that. And it's like, well, why am I even here then?
Yeah.
I'm going to stop you right there. It's
not going to work. Yeah, exactly. Well, the thing is that oftentimes it's not even that. It's people saying, yeah, that's a great idea. And then it gets under-resourced. It gets slowed down.
Sure.
That's the ones you
even
have to
worse,
people
right?
Who say, that's a great idea.
Yeah.
I'm behind it. And then it just, there's like little things and you just get, you know, suddenly a year has gone by.
I'll give
by
you two engineers for that great idea.
Exactly.
That's why you don't want to work for big companies. And if you're in, really, if you're in cutting edge stuff, it's a challenge because especially AI, you need resources to do it, but you don't want to work for a big company because they're going to get in the way. So
they're going to want to do what they want to.
Yeah. What's really fun is when you get a company that does have an effective team or does have they have a lot of resources and you can do crazy things, you know, and you can, you know, so there have been moments, you know, that, you know, we've gotten to do really things that you could never do that are like, oh, we spent $500,000 on that. It kind of worked. Okay, well, let's write that down and let's not do that again. We'll
it's the exception that proves the rule, though, isn't it? I mean, those times are few and far between.
They are. It's usually when you're living somewhere in the front end of what they're trying to figure out.
And you lucked in before they got before the gatekeepers got there, before the bean counters figured it out.
At some point, someone comes in and says, wow, we're spending a lot of money on something that isn't working. And then they cut back. But it's a great moment.
Yeah.
And I've been fortunate to be in a lot of those great moments. And it's a good place to be for a little while. And you just jump. You try to ride one set to the next,
Break out the rubber finger. We're number one. Well, we're number two. Microsoft's Edge has now been surpassed by Apple's Safari in desktop browser popularity. Something to celebrate? Probably not. Woo! And actually, this is a kind of maybe more of a victory. Both ARM and Microsoft are taking a look at the Apple M series chips and saying we better play some catch up here. Apparently, Microsoft has put some job listings up for people to do specialized ARM based chips for their hardware. I'm sure looking at the efficiency of the Apple chips.
They have to look at the Apple chips, and I think the problem is that you also have to look at, you need to own the whole hardware subset, the stack. You need to you need to build the programming platform. You need there's a whole bunch of things that make the M1 work better than a lot of other things. That is going to be really complicated for people to reproduce.
Behind the scenes, Microsoft has really moved along with Windows on ARM. And I would say they're 80% of the way there. I mean, so it's interesting. I mean, that's why they're probably starting to look at hardware at this point. They've not been sitting still on this.
Right. Yeah.
But one of the problems is that they have 80% of the market, which means that they're only going to hold on to 80% of the market if everybody who has every need for every type of computer can realize that and run Windows on it. So they can't do something like Apple's been able to do three times now, which is say, hey, guess what? We're changing the entire platform. And now all developers are going to have to make sure that you change your tune and do exactly what we say so that you're prepared for this change that we're doing in the next year or two. Windows, I mean, how long did it take for Microsoft to get people off of Windows XP? I mean, this is the difficulty they have. All they can do is add, instead of having four different distinct Windows flavors and markets, they'll have a fifth one, maybe one that will be more power efficient, but they'll still have a fifth one.
Apple's quarterly results Thursday, firing up the six color graph generator.
Indeed.
Bank of America says, prepare for bad news. I'm sure Apple's probably
Apple said that too. It's going to be tough. The question is, how tough? Will it be tough in the sense of like Apple only made several $1 billion in profit, but not several lenty team?
Yeah, this may be Apple sandbagging because Facebook had surprisingly good results. Amazon, Google, the results weren't horrible. And so they've all been reporting in the last few weeks. So Microsoft had a very good quarter. So maybe Apple's just sandbagging.
It's entirely possible.
And also we talked about the Google's quarterly results on the Material podcast last week with Florence Ion. And the thing is like all the financial analysts are saying, oh, Google had a wonderful, wonderful quarterly earnings call. And when you look at the numbers and you look at the analysis, they're saying, we thought they would really suck. Instead, only sucked.
It's wonderful compared to what? Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. Yeah, but after the Mac riding high for so long, like there's a feeling now that everybody did buy those new Macs during the pandemic, and now you're feeling it where those not.
So your predictions, Mac sales going to be where will they be?
I mean, they'll be down. I don't know. I don't know about a number, but they'll be down year over year. And iPhone will be down year over year.
Yeah, but this is not a good quarter for iPhone anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a great quarter for Apple anyway either.
Yeah.
And so it'll be down. But again, my prediction would be it'll be down and it might even be their worst quarter in several years. And they'll still, make a ton of money.
It'll be less insanely profitable, but that's, I mean, I think that's where Apple sits. I will say, though, working across a lot of companies and talking to a lot of companies and even the projects we see going by, I have never seen a corporate pullback like we're seeing right now, other than COVID. Like it is.
We're feeling it. Are you kidding? We've had cancellations across the board. Right. Yeah.
I've never seen, you know, and for me, because my job is countercyclical, everyone's asking, how do we use virtual events to, we're canceling all these events for the summer and the fall. Yeah. How do we use the event? How do we use, you know, virtual stuff? So that whole thing is coming back up again because they don't want to, you know, they're canceling lots of events. That's what I notice, you know, and they're pulling back. And I don't, other than COVID, I've never seen so many companies so worried. And I don't, what's weird is that I don't see it. Like, you don't see it in the stock market. You don't see it on the day to day.
Yeah. It's like, well, inflation's down. The market's doing well. Why are you so worried? But
there's a whole bunch of
things. They know something. Somebody's maybe reading. We don't know.
It feels like they know something and we don't know what it is. And because I don't see it on the surface, other than seeing everybody canceling, laying off, you know, cutting.
Look at all the layoffs this year. Yeah. I mean, more than 250,000 layoffs in the tech sector.
Usually that happens after the recession starts to come in, you know, not, you know, when
maybe they're just skittish. You
know, when I've got my charts up here, so I'm going to give you a prediction just because it's fun.
Oh, good. How exciting.
Which is last year at this quarter, they did $97.3 billion in revenue.
Yeah.
But I'm going to say, let's say 90. So it'll be actually up from 2 years ago quarter, but down by $7 billion from
quarter.
Okay. So 90. Nice round 90. Number for you. That'll be my prediction. And it'll be enough that people will freak out. But also, if you look back to 2021, you'll realize it's more than they made. They took last year off in terms of this. So, yeah, we'll see.
90 B, and that's revenue, not
that's
obviously.
That's the revenue number. But a number like that is going to give you what? It's going to give you $20 billion in profit.
Seems good.
Yeah.
I'll take it.
Unless you're a Wall Street, an analyst or an investor or somebody who's always concerned with the growth figures and nothing else. And I would argue that you shouldn't even probably listen to those people this time, because everybody knows that this cycle is going to pick up and that there are going to be new iPhones in the fall and that Apple's still making a lot of money and that they're still, if you look at their growth, every time people have said, oh no, Apple's growth has stalled, they have a new iPhone design and it kicks it off again.
And so you know what? If you're wrong, we'll get Mr. Snippity Snip in here. He'll fix it in post, and then next week you'll look great.
Yeah, it's great. And also, I'm not here next week, so if I'm wrong, bye, suckers.
Where are you going?
I'm just visiting my mom.
Oh, that's right. Birthday. We talked about that. Yeah, we'll miss you next week, but we'll find somebody to fill your shoes.
I'm taking my shoes with me.
Yeah, but you left a big dent in that chair, so maybe we can find somebody
perfect
to fit.
Fit my dent. Go ahead.
Someone to spackle Jason's chair. Spackle Jason's butt. Damn it.
Nobody can fill this dent. I got a massive dent.
I sat in it 3 weeks ago.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
They let you?
They let me sit in the captain's chair.
John, we got to talk.
I asked if it was allowed. They said yes.
Okay. I guess I can live with it. We're going to take a little break here and come back with your picks of the week. So if you would prepare those, my friends, while I remind everybody the best place in the world to be, the Club Twit Discord. What a great hang. And all you got to do is pay $7 a month. Oh, yeah, sure. There are other benefits. Ad-free versions of all of our shows. Ad-free and tracker-free. There's also the Twit Plus feed, which has shows we don't put out anywhere else, like the Hands on Mac show with Micah Sargent, Hands on Windows with Paul Thurrott, Untitled Linux show, the Giz Fizz, and brand new Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson. Now, how much would you pay? Well, it's still only $7 a month, less than a blue check on Twitter, and you get so much more. We invite you to join Club Twit. Oh, and there's the best part of all. You get that warm and fuzzy feeling knowing you are really helping us continue to produce great content and produce new content. We've launched a lot of shows now in the club, like This Week in Space, that have gone out into the public, and we're very happy about that. $7 a month, twit.tv/clubtwit, and I thank you in advance. Burke says, you didn't sit in my chair. You sat in the backup Dr. Evil chair. There are two.
Yeah, I see it. Okay.
Fine. You can sit in any chair you want. You're always welcome. In fact, next time you're here, we'll get the second chair and you could sit.
Oh, boy.
That's
just going to confuse people.
There's two Dr. Evils. Jason, since you aren't going to be here next week, give us a great pick of the week. What do you say?
Okay, I will. It is called Stop the Madness. It's a Safari extension. It'll run on Mac and iOS.
I like it already. I don't even know what the madness is.
It is from Underpass Software. Jeffrey Johnson is the guy's name. And what doesn't it do? it unbreaks web pages that are broken by dumb web developers. So let's say a website disables copy and paste.
I hate that because then I can't use my password manager.
Yeah, or it doesn't let you use contextual menus or does auto-playing video. You install Stop the Madness and you don't get like one feature. This is like a what doesn't it do of browser extension. There are like 50 different checkboxes of things it does. Bypass link shorteners, hide banners, protect the command click, protect drag and drop. And my feature that I wrote about last week on Six Colors that I love is there's also custom CSS. So like I went to a website, it might have been 9to5 Mac, and they have a new feature, which is they put a comment from their forums in the story. Top comment from a commenter.
Oh, please.
And I don't want to see your comments. I don't care that it's top. I don't want to see it. Well, all I did was right-click, inspect element in Safari, got the CSS for it, and then you go into Stop the Madness, and you say, CSS display colon none, and it overrides their CSS, and it goes away.
So that's how this works.
There's so many things that it does. But there's a website that I visit a lot that doesn't let me open in a new window. So command click doesn't open the link in a new window. Stop the Madness fixes it. Now I can do that like I should have been able to do before. It's just, if you've been annoyed by the web, it's $10.
$8 for the mobile version. $10 for the desktop version.
Oh yeah, that's fair. And then also it does redirect management too. So if you've got like a page that you always want to go to a different page, you can actually set in a pattern and it'll redirect your browser there. So I use that because I subscribe to one of our local newspapers and not the other one, but I always get links for the Mercury News.
Right.
And I have a rule that when I click on a Mercury News link, it opens in the Marin IJ.
I want the IJ, baby.
So yeah, Stop the Madness. What doesn't it do?
That's really clever. For by the way, not just Safari, but on the desktop, Firefox, Chrome, and Chromium.
Yeah.
So it does it.
I've been using that for a long time. It's a great, it's a great tool.
Jeff Johnson, $10 on desktop, $8 on mobile. Stop
the madness. All one word, which I love, because that's madness in and of itself.
Andy Anako, are you going to go to an estate sale in the near future?
I've been to an estate sale. This is why I have this. This is why I bought this.
Where else would you get a ship in a bottle?
There you go.
Is anybody still making ships in a bottle?
No. Apparently. Well, okay. Well, apparently I don't know how long ago that dude built this one, but apparently it's
a pretty old looking bottle.
Yeah. It's an old looking bottle, pretty old looking ship. It's a very lovely.
It's nicely done because it has water. I mean, like some sort of cloudy substance.
Frothy turbulent seas.
Nice.
It's a good name brand. 4/4 of a quart bottle there with a,
cork. It's got a cork in it.
What kind of cork it is? Yeah. But yeah. So I went to an estate sale over the weekend. This is the nice time
Andy,
of year.
Andy, how do you find estate sales near you?
Well, I was not interested at all until I found this website called estatesales.net, which is just, it's just an estate sale finder where you just
plug in,
here's your zip code and tell them like, how far away are you willing to travel? And also, do you want to include auctions? Do you want to include moving sales? Do you want to include a whole bunch of other stuff? And it will just simply give you a list of everything that's happening.
And some of these are online, by the way, I noticed.
Some of these are online. Like it'll also include, again, if you include that checkbox, some of them will include like actual auction houses.
Here's a chair you can have, Jason. Next time you're here, I'll get you this chair.
Excellent.
Just a lifetime of treasures.
Just tie that on. Yeah. Slide it in here. Put Jason's chair on it on like a post-it note so no one else sits in it.
This is a great site. I love this site.
It's really, really cool. You can also have it just basically email you alerts every time there's like a new listing for somewhere. The estatesales.net just got bought by another company for like $40 million.
Wow.
So it shows you how big they are and how successful they are. I'm sure there are a couple of other sites for this kind of thing, but it's the only one that I actually bothered with. And it's not like I'm packing up the car every single weekend to, stock my eBay store or anything like that. But if I find out that there is a decent estate sale, like within bike distance of my house, I'm in there, because I refer to it, I think of it as burglary fantasy camp, because you enter an unlocked door, you walk in, you open drawers and closets, you take things, put them in your bag. You do have to pay off someone to at the door, to not squeal on you, and usually it's a amount of money kind of commensurate with
how much was the ship in a bottle.
This, actually, I bought like a whole bag full of stuff for like $50.
Nice.
So this would be a whole, and what I like about estate sales is that you do see like weird stuff, like odd things, including like old computers, old books, old stuff like that. But also things like, I'm not joking. Like just like the estate sale was like on Friday morning. Like on Wednesday, I was thinking, I was doing food shopping and I was in like the little housewares aisle in the supermarket, had one of those like fish spatulas. And I thought, get one of those.
Because I've always wanted a fish spatula.
Yeah. But I didn't get it. And then of course at the estate sale, like I'm rummaging through the kitchen drawers and hey, look, fish spatula. All right, there you go. It's a perfectly good, perfectly new like fish spatula that cost me a fraction of $50.
I am of an age now where I'm starting to think about what's going to happen to all this crap we've collected in the studio when I kick, right? And so imagine the estate sale that we'll have here. You might want to run up and pick up something yourself, right. Jason. Sound like your fabulous,
like a studio sale,
specially sculpted chair. Oh, a studio sale.
I'm looking for the giant cog. I'll put money down dented. For the giant cog.
And some of these are online. So, you know, here's one in Winter Park, yeah, exactly. Florida, where I can get for $30 a large jar of glass marbles. I mean, where else are you going to get that? Yeah. You know,
it's fun to just browse, like, and for everyone that I actually go to, there are probably like 30 or 40 that I'm just week to week to say, hey, oh, wow, look, hey, antiques, memorabilia, comic books and a chanting ephemera. I
think this is exciting. I like estate sales.
Yeah.
Lisa's going to be very interested because she likes estate jewelry. And, you know, she has a number of very beautiful old brooches and things that she's picked up. And I think this would be a lot of fun. Maybe for Mother's Day, it might not be too late for me to gift her with a fine brooch or a chair with a specially sculpted bottom or you know, a glass jar of marbles. Perfect for Mother's Day. EstateSales.net. Thank you, Andy. Is your house loaded with stuff?
No. Well, between the MIT flea market and I kind of like tapered off of things, but I do. But most of the good stuff in my house are stuff from like local like yard sales and estate sales.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I'm lucky in that I am a moderate to low income person who lives in like a seaside quaint village full of lots of people who have lots of money. And so oftentimes they're like, well, you know what? I have two $500 Cuisinarts, but I suppose I should get a third $500 Cuisinart. But now I have one $500 Cuisinart that was $5, whatever. Just get out of my house. And so oftentimes the nicest stuff are things like for people with no sense of money anymore have said that.
So when you go to an estate sale, is it often in the house of the deceased?
It's not necessarily the deceased. In this case, it was someone who retired. I wish I could tell you the story of this person because he had such an interesting. He's having such an interesting life, but he's now like 90 and he moved to be closer to his kids.
Yeah.
And so
you want to get rid of. I'm ready to do that. Get rid of a lot of stuff.
All right.
Yeah. And so
I want to move away from my kids, but it's, you know, similar.
Same thing.
Similar premise. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, and so like most of they hired an estate sale company that after the family had basically taken, after he had moved everything that he wanted and all the family like got all the things that they wanted, an estate sale company came in, photographed what was left. It's not like a fleet. It's not like a garage sale where there's tables really set up. It's pretty much literally, again, I'm not joking, like, oh, let's open up this drawer. Hey, look, here's all the utensils.
Is there anything in the house you could take?
Yeah. I mean, anything
you see is available
for sale. Well,
and this is kind of a relief to me because honestly, I'm kind of worried about what's going to happen. We could just do that here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what? The last time I moved, I kind of did the exact same thing. Only it was, I'm going to pack everything that I want to keep. I'm going to put into storage everything I want to put into storage. I'm going to give away the things I want to give away. The rest of it, I'm going to pay a nice couple of guys in a truck, $1,200 to simply say everything that is remaining in this house, put it in your truck and take it elsewhere. Sell it, burn it, whatever you want to do. Just get it out of the house for me, and they'll do that.
You never know what you're going to get. For instance, here's some looks like pet food bowls with the pet food still in it. So you're just
that's
you get that, it's, again, that's a bonus.
Fascinating. That's the fascinating thing, because in this sale, like he was ex-military, and so he had a couple of civil, he had a Civil War like Navy scabbard,
scimitar,
or whatever, and a couple other cool things from like the Civil War that he collected. But also,
it's a good thing you weren't a burglar; he might have chopped your head off.
Yeah, there. Exactly. But also, like, as I'm looking at the pic, the 60 pictures that are inside this gallery of, oh, here's what can you expect to find there. It's like, oh, would I really go there and just buy, like, here are like all like those little plastic jars of spices that you accumulate over like 20 years. Like, I would probably rather buy fresh spices. I don't
yeah.
just buy.
Old spices, not so good.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can't stop looking.
I know, it's very browsable.
I'm looking at these people's house as they sell everything, I don't know if those women's feet are for sale, but this is really strange. Really. Alex Lindsay, distract me quick before I buy something I don't really want.
Well, I bought something that I thought I would need and then didn't need for a long time. And it just sat around in my garage.
Yes.
And, my garage, someday we'll do a sale for my garage. I call it.
You have had sales and we have taken advantage of them.
Yeah. Exactly. Yes. So I still have a lot of, I call it kind of spelunking, because there's a bunch of boxes and they're up in an attic, and I kind of start pulling through them and I find all this stuff. And one of the things I knew that was sitting there somewhere was this Ambio mic. This is a Sennheiser Ambio mic that I had bought for some spherical project maybe 10 years ago.
The good news is the client bought it, but you've got it.
Well, the client paid me to do a project, and I knew I needed that mic, and I bought it.
Yeah.
And then I used it for that project.
Yeah.
And then I
now it's just sitting around.
I forgot about it.
Yeah.
It sat around, and it wasn't that successful in the project because the streaming platform didn't do it very well, and it was kind of like, oh, okay. Well,
those were early days.
Anyway, we picked it back up again. Yeah. And what we did at NAB was we took this ambisonic mic. This is using an ambisonic mic. So it has an array of microphones, four of them, and it'll do four XLR outs, and it's a specific pattern. And what we did is we plugged that into a sound device's Scorpio. And then we went out of that and embedded those into an SDI signal, put them into a live view, and streamed it back to our office. And with a live view. And so what we did is we had this Ambio mic in channels, you know, whatever, 4 through 8, and two microphones, the people walking around NAB with the microphones. And the reason that I find that interesting, we're going to talk more about it in office hours in the near future, but a lot of people, when I said I was going to do that, thought I was crazy. You know, they thought that this was a nutty, you know, and I do a lot of nutty things, so it's reasonable to think that it's nutty.
But it's just Alex at it again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I had this idea, like, what if we were able to capture the feel of being there? You know, not just the SM58s with the, you know,
no, let's get the surround sound.
All the traditional, like, how do we get the rest of it in there? And it worked stunningly well. Like,
now, you have it so people were watching in a VR headset so that when they turned their head and stuff, or?
No, you could. We could do that. We didn't. So what we did is we're one of the, I don't know how many channels right now have 5.1, but our YouTube channel can do 5.1. And so what we did is we shot it in HDR 10 and 5.1 surround. Wow. And so it was an HDR stream going through a live view. So live view, the 800 has the ability to do 10 bit. So we were able to send back an HDR signal back to San Rafael from Las Vegas, and convert that to an HDR 10 signal that goes to YouTube along with 5.1 audio. And again, it was one of those things that I felt I had a hint that it would work really well, and it works exceptionally well. It's just a test. It's not published right now, but what we found was is that by having this Ambio, the cool thing is we didn't have tons of mics. We had four. And it was this little thing, and someone just walked behind it with a pole. They just had a pole behind the thing embedding this in. But you really felt like you were there. You felt like you could hear the louder booth over and behind you, and something else is there. But the mics, and what's cool about it is because we use that Ambio separately, we could control how much of that background noise is there. So we could bring it all down a little bit. And the microphones that are being used, we're not using that for the people talking. We're still talking into microphones. And so you could control how much audience there was, you know, in those surround speakers. And it was, anyway,
I went from going, oh, Ambisonic is pretty cool, to, wow, this is really cool. And there's less expensive versions. This one's like $1,300. This is the one we used. There are more expensive versions. AKG just came out with an 8-mic version of this that is amazing. Zoom has a much less expensive version that's $300 or $400.
Yeah, Zoom's done this, right, with multiple microphones pinning.
They have multiple, but they have XY. This is Zoom has a little one, a little Ambisonic one that you can use. And the cool thing is you can take that Ambisonic information and then decode it and put it back in as beds for other surround sound things that are out there. But it really creates the space in which something, even if your primary focus is just a microphone, I was kind of amazed at how immersive it felt. And so
could you use it like a handheld mic and talk to people?
No, you wouldn't want to do that.
You wouldn't want to move it around. You want to have it.
No, because you want to have it be something that's grabbing all the environment. What you want to do is have that walk around mic that is still, because by having something like an SM58 and having it have a lot of off axis rejection, so it gets rid of all of that. You have two pristine channels that you can put in the center channel.
And then you can mix it.
And then you have all this other stuff that you can mix in to taste, you know, and figure out, you know, what makes sense, you know, for that experience. And it's for those out there doing, you know, watch the show, I know a fair number of them, you know, there's definitely a group of MacBreak folks that are in broadcast. It's worth looking at. I mean, it's really I know it sounds crazy to go past stereo and go into 5.1, and but it's a really cool, really cool.
Well, it's interesting because years ago, because the technology wasn't there, but it's there now. And times have, and so this mic, I mean, mics don't change. So this,
I mean, the fact that I was doing this with a relatively simple rig, and I think it was the first time anybody's done 5.1 from a show floor
live.
So it's live. It was like a live stream from there in APR 5.1.
Were you mixing? Was somebody mixing?
Yeah. So, well, the funny thing is that it was pretty much straight channels into the live view. And then it went back to San Rafael, and Mickey Macachor, who's in the Philippines, he's part of Office Hours. He was actually running the software. So we were using L-Acoustics Elisa Studio along with and I can't think of the name of it right off the top of my head, something that'll interpret the Ambisonic and feed it back in. So he's running the mix. So the mix was actually being done in San Rafael from the raw data. So there's the mic data and the Ambisonic data.
And Mickey's sitting there in the Philippines going like this.
Well, first he was swearing at us because Kevin and I were trying to figure something out. Of course, I didn't know what I was doing. And we were testing it the day before and we screwed up all the channels. And so it was all screwed up for the first half hour. And then he figured out what we did and tightened it all up and made it work. But so when it started working, it was really, you know, really fun. And we're going to be doing that in more of our coverage. I mean, my goal is by the fall, everything we cover will use 5.1, you know, like in the Ambisonic mic and everything else. And it's
this is why you want to watch Office Hours, officehours.global, because these guys are nuts, but they're nuts in an interesting way that, you know, could be very useful in 10, 15 years when it's no longer bleeding edge.
They're very well mic'd nuts.
Yeah. Well, all kinds of nuts. I mean, he's doing all kinds of crazy things. Officehours.global.
Yeah. I mean, I think that we're constantly trying to figure out what's the next thing, you know, and how do you take the advantage that we have is because we're doing a show every day. We're constantly like, well, we'll just keep pushing that edge until that edge becomes normal, until we're not thinking about it anymore. And we're, you know, hopefully moving the industry forward a little bit.
But don't forget Gray Matter, that great podcast at graymatter.show that Alex does with Michael Krasny and great guests. Justine this week.
She was on this. She's on this week. We dropped the interview. It was a great interview with Justine.
Yeah. Wow. Very cool. Very cool. And I'm presuming that you didn't write this blurb that Michael did. When British novelist Robert Graves wrote I, Claudius about the fourth Roman emperor, he set the stage for our interview with Justina Zarek. I can actually hear that in Krasny's voice. Yeah.
He does great opens, though. Like it's every time he introduces someone, it's like this massive.
He's famous. Yeah.
You know, yeah.
And I want to hear I still haven't heard the Walter Murch one, but I'm dying to hear that one as well.
Every one of these is a gem.
Well done.
Really good interviews. Yeah.
That's graymatter.show. Office Hours is at officehours.global. And if you want to hire this guy, as many do, to be your guru for your next streaming event, 090.media for the day job. Thank you, Alex.
Thank you.
Andy Iannocco, WGBH in Boston, Thursday.
Thursday, 12:30. Go to WGBHnews.org to listen to it live or later.
And at an estate sale near you.
You don't never know.
Don't fight him. The guy's tough. He's tough.
He throws an elbow if he needs to.
Boom.
Only I'm just saying those Johnny Mathis albums are mine.
That chip in a bottle, it could be a weapon. You don't know.
I'll do crazy things for Johnny Mathis.
If I could put a chip in a bottle. Mr. Jason Snell, have a great time with your mom.
Thank you.
I think it's a great thing you're doing for Mother's Day.
She lives out in the middle of nowhere in Arizona. Great times, hard to come by, but times will be had.
Middle of nowhere, Arizona is one of my favorite places.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
You're going to have a great time. Mm-hmm. We will miss you next week. Back the week after. Okay. Thank you for being here. SixColors.com. He will be. Don't be confused. Yes. He will be doing the Apple charts.
I'll even do the thing where after all the results are done, I will live stream it on YouTube and I will talk you through the charts.
Remember, $90 billion revenue prediction.
That's my prediction.
Yep.
I'll see.
He's on the record for that.
Yep.
We'll watch the live stream. You find out more at sixcolors.com. All his podcasts are sixcolors.jason. And you won't be here, but your name will be invoked many, many times next week.
Use my charts.
We use them
as needed.
Every week we use
them. As indicated.
I mean, every month, every quarter.
Every quarter.
You know what? We use them whenever we feel.
That's
like
right.
It.
I don't own those colors. Those colors are for everyone.
We do Mac Break Weekly every Tuesday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern, 1800 UTC. If you want to join us live, you can. We stream live audio and video at live.twit.tv. If you're watching live, you might as well hang with some people who are also watching live. There's two places to do that. Of course, the IRC open to all at irc.twit.tv. There's also the Discord for our Club Twit members. After the fact, on-demand versions of the show are available at the website, twit.tv/MBW. If you're there, you'll also see a link to our YouTube channel where you can watch every show. We put them all up there. You can also subscribe, and we have links to various well-known podcatchers, but we also have an RSS link, so you can use that for any podcaster. If you subscribe, you'll get it the minute it's available every Tuesday afternoon. We thank you all for being here. Hope you enjoyed the show, and I hope we'll see you next week. But for now, I'm sorry to say, you got to get back to work. No more browsing estate sales, because break time is over. Bye-bye.
It's midweek, and you really want to know even more about the world of technology. So you should check out Tech News Weekly, the show where we talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news.
It's the biggest news. We talk with the people writing the stories that you're probably reading. We also talk between ourselves about the stories that are getting us even more excited about tech news this week.
So if you're excited, well, then join us. Head to twit.tv/TNW to subscribe.